Welcome to the Space Coast meeting, January 23rd, 2010. Would you all please rise to the Pledge of Allegiance? Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. We have a few announcements briefly. I would like to thank Liz Mandeville from Sunrise Bank and Katie's Custom Cuisine for all the goodies that you guys are having this morning. And it did look delicious. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Katie. Quick note on Space Coast's 12th annual trade show. It will be held on March 20th at the Crown Plaza, Melbourne, Oceanside. We ran out of room in almost every other place last year, and this year we're taking over the whole hotel, all their ballrooms. So I hope all of you can make it. The next President's Forum will be on February the 13th. And today's program is, we have quite a unique opportunity. We have Paul from Becker and Polyakov here. And I would like to turn the meeting over to Paul as soon as my videographer hooks up. The program today is being presented by Carl from Becker and Polyakov, and I will introduce the administrator of Carl, who will do all the following introductions. Ms. Diana Zayas-Bazan.
Good morning. I'd like to thank everyone and Roger Kesselbach and the Space Coast Communities Association for inviting Becker and Polyakov and Community Association Leadership Lobby to be your presenters this morning. Before I introduce our panelists, I'd like to mention to you, if you haven't already registered for our seminar on March 12th in Melbourne at the Holiday Inn Vieira Beach, please do so. And you can do that by signing up at the table that I have there and giving me your information. We'll mail you an invitation and register you. Or you may go to the CAWL website and register yourself. We'd love to see you all there. I'd like to present or introduce Travis Moore. He's one of our panelists, and he is our legislative advocate for our Community Association Leadership Lobby, and also, I believe, he's on FLA. And we have Scott Kiernan. He is an attorney at our Orlando office, and he is the person here that will be at your association in 45 minutes. So if you call us, you can have Scott come to your meetings or, you know, answer your questions. We also have David Muller, he is the co-director of Community Association Leadership Lobby. He is also an attorney at our Sarasota office. And now I'll turn it over to Ken Director. He is an attorney at our Fort Lauderdale office and our West Palm Beach office. He is also the chair of our practice group throughout the state of Florida. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Diana. Can everybody hear me okay? A little louder. I got to save my voice. I haven't yelled at my kids for a day and a half. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming out, and especially thank you to those of you that gave up a good tea time on a day with such wonderful weather. We'll try to get you to your afternoon tea times in a comfortable time. David, you and I have to wait until tomorrow. My name is Ken Director. I've been with the firm 24 years, and I'm the chair, as Diana said, of our Community Association Practice Group. And we're very pleased to have a chance to talk to you about CAWL and also to hear from you and engage with you in some discussion as to what has happened in Tallahassee in the past year, the perspectives of those that you elect to represent you. Some of those perspectives might surprise you. Some of those perspectives might disturb you. And also to talk with you about how you can convey to your representatives your perspectives as to what's happening. You've all heard the joke about never wanting to see how laws and sausages are made. And there's a reason that it's become sort of a punchline, and there's a reason it keeps getting repeated, because it would appall you to know what forces are at play when decisions are made that affect your daily lives. How many of you are board members? How many of you are unit owners in a condominium or HOA or co-op? All of you. The decisions that are being made in Tallahassee are affecting you very directly, and probably in the most direct way possible. And when I say that, I'm talking about your wallet. The legislation that has evolved over the last couple of years that we're going to talk about in a few minutes is to the interest of several industries. You guys can't waive an audit more than 2 years in a row. You guys have to have an engineer check out your building once every 5 years. And, of course, whatever the engineer finds to be wrong, you're going to have to fix. And what are the odds of an engineer coming to your building and finding nothing wrong?
Zero.
Fannie Mae has issued guidelines that says you won't loan money unless you have at least 10% of your reserves funded. And some of the local lenders are exaggerating those guidelines to require even greater reserve funding. Where does that money come from that goes into reserves? It comes from you. The insurance industry has got a very nice situation here because you have to carry insurance. One of the issues we're going to discuss today is whether or not as individual owners you should be required to pay the extra premiums to buy an individual policy. I have my own opinions as to whether or not the state should mandate that. The elevator retrofits that so many of you are facing at a time when everybody's paying their assessments. The fire sprinkler retrofits, for which the deadline is coming up pretty quick. 2014 seemed like a long time away. A couple years ago, it's not so far away now. And those fire sprinkler retrofits can run as much as $8,000, $10,000, $15,000 a unit, I've heard estimates. These decisions that are being made in Tallahassee, if you think this is just ivory tower talk, these decisions are affecting you. And what is happening is you guys who live in condominiums, this is my opinion, you guys who live in the condominiums are being viewed as the monetary source to bail out a lot of the industries in Florida that are suffering and the source of income that is going to reinvigorate our economy. How about your economy? How about some relief to help you generate cash flow for your communities? How about some relief that gets the banks to start paying a fairer share of what's accrued on the units when they get around to foreclosing 2 or 3 years after the delinquency has started? So if you think that the things we're talking about exist in a faraway land, that is no longer the case. So what happened a few years back was we realized that we have a megaphone which we are not using. And that megaphone is all you. Our firm represents over 4,000 communities across the state of Florida. The insurance industry has a loud voice, I should say, in Tallahassee. The mortgage bankers industry has a loud voice in Tallahassee. The fire marshals and the plumbers who got through this legislation that is making you install fire sprinklers, they got a pretty loud voice in Tallahassee. They're all well-funded. But there's one thing that none of them gets to do every November. They don't get to vote. So it's time for your legislators to hear from the people who put them there. And it is difficult to make that happen because none of you has, quote-unquote, a lobbyist. And none of you has the organization to help you funnel that input to Tallahassee to a single source. And that single source is the gentleman sitting down there to your right on the far side of the table. That's Travis Moore. He is our lobbyist. And I realize lobbyist, many of you view it as a pejorative term, a dirty word, and probably with good reason if you read the paper. But I'm here to tell you, just like lawyers, they're not all bad. I realize that may be hard to believe and it may sound self-serving, but they're not all bad. Our goal when we set up CALL was to do exactly what I just described, was to give you the ability to funnel your input into a source and have that source speak for you and have the legislators in Tallahassee realize that he was speaking for hundreds of thousands of property owners and voters in Florida when he conveys your perspective on Florida statutes, what they do say, what they shouldn't say, what they should say to your legislators. It is still a difficult battle, and Travis will tell you what it's like to try to compete for the attention of legislators with very well-funded lobbyists, but that's what Call is all about. And some of the mechanics of Call, David, I'm going to ask you to follow up just quickly to talk not only about our Call surveys and the most recent survey results, but also about some of the features on the Call websites that people can use to access the website, get information as to who their contact should be, and then I'm going to ask Travis to talk about how you can track bills using the Call website. Go ahead, David.
Very good. I'm assuming the microphone works. I wanted to just talk a little bit about some of the things we do at Call. Like Ken mentioned, the goal is to actually empower the people. Because as you know, on several of these bills, we've been doing battle with the banks and other entities, and unfortunately, we weren't given $700 billion to fund our lobbyists. So, like Ken mentioned, it's very important for you all to, number one, be educated on what's going on out there, and to actually voice your opinion and contact your senators and your representatives. One way we try to influence the politicians is by periodically having surveys done, where we poll our members. I know probably many of you in this room participated in our most recent survey that we just did a couple months ago, and I wanted to go over a couple of those survey results just to give you a pulse for what's actually going on in Florida. First of all, we had almost 1,000 respondents on the survey, and of those, some of the highlights of the survey are as follows. 85% of the survey respondents expect foreclosures, delinquencies, and revenue shortfalls to either increase or remain unchanged in 2010, 85%. 44% of the respondents expect property values to continue to decline through March 2010. 64% say that new legal mandates from Tallahassee have forced them to upgrade or retrofit certain building components in the past several years. And then this is the kicker. 92% said they would support a legislative proposal that would increase the amount of assessments a foreclosing mortgagee or a bank would have to pay at the time of taking title. Now, obviously, considering who we were polling, it's not surprising that that number was 92%. However, I think it really is striking in the fact that that issue affects all of you. Whether you're a homeowners association, a cooperative, a condominium, that issue is paramount to the financial survival of your associations. So that's one of the things we're going to talk about today. But, and I'll hand it off to Travis here in a second, but we really need you to be active and get to know your representatives and senators. At a minimum, get to know their email addresses. Because as Travis will tell you, when these bills are heard in committee, a lot of times the politicians look to their email inbox. And if they have three messages on a particular bill, they're going to say to themselves, well, that must not be a very important item in my district. But if they get 1,000 emails on a specific bill, you better, you know, they're going to pay attention. They're going to ask their legislative aide, now, what SB 1196, what's that about again? And that's what we need to do. So with that, I'll let Travis explain a little bit more how Call works.
Thanks, David. And I also want to thank again the leadership of this group, Roger, and somebody that I consider a real mentor, Harry Charles, for inviting us here today to participate. And as Ken mentioned, each and every one of you is a special interest, and you do, especially those of you who are board members, I mean, you represent communities that are, in many cases, iconic parts of a various district. I want to back up and speak real briefly about the importance of banding together and have your voice heard. This year is going to be a very, very, very busy and hectic year on all kinds of issues, but particularly community association issues. The prevailing factor that's going to be kind of over the legislature as they begin in March, the beginning of March, their annual legislative session, is the fact that it's an election year. 2010 is an election year, and unlike any election year since 1886, we have every statewide office is on the ballot. Not only are they on the ballot, but the unique item is that there is not one incumbent running for the seat that they currently hold. They're all running for something else. Our governor is running for the U.S. Senate. Our CFO is running for governor. Our attorney general running for governor, etc. And it's created an opportunity for us because they are all in a listening mode. The other thing that's kind of happening right now that happens once every 10 years is the reapportionment process. They are now beginning, and the two things that legislators pay attention to or politicians are number one, the votes when it's an election year, they're paying attention to what you think of their votes on certain issues, and then number two, what their district is going to look like, because they want to know what voters are going to be in their district. So this year is going to be a year where they are very much paying attention to your voice. My job is to do nothing more than to point the megaphone, as Ken mentioned, of your collective voices directly toward the right door or the right listening ear at that particular time. As a general philosophy, we try to maintain the balance between the responsibilities and the rights of the community, the common interest ownership community as a whole, and those rights and responsibilities of each individual owner. This year, there is a plethora of bills that have already been filed, and we're going to talk a little bit about why that is because of the carryover from 2009 here in a little bit, about why 2010 already has a larger than normal load. But as we go through at call and we begin to look at those bills and analyze them, we then do a lot of the work for you so that you don't have to follow every day what's happening, who's filing what. We put those bills that are important on the call website, which is...
Chance, before you go, I want to interject a comment and a question.
Sure.
Because a lot of you are probably sitting there thinking, I don't want to spend my time reading a 100-page bill, most of which I won't understand. I got to tell you, I don't enjoy doing it either. But it is important for you to use the website, not because we expect all of you to grind your way through all these bills, but it's important for you to see who is sponsoring them. It's important for you to see the analysis and discussion of the bills that is in layman terms, either from the lawyers who write for the website or from your peers around the state who comment on the bills. It is important for you to see who is on the committees before which the bill is about to be heard and discussed, so you can see if it's your legislator. And Travis, what I wanted to come back to you with as a question is, if I could characterize the legislative attitude toward condo associations, how many of you are condo association representatives or members? Homeowners, and how many are homeowners associations? Okay, you're pretty vastly outnumbered. But we're not going to ignore you. I think it's fair to characterize the legislative attitude over the last couple of years as basically this simple. Unit owner good, board member bad. Unit owner can be trusted, board member can't be trusted. We have to create every conceivable regulation we can to take power away from these people who want to sit on boards and spend your money and do whatever other nefarious things they have in mind for the association. And I get the impression that that has sort of subsided, and there's now a recognition that type of legislation has made it not only undesirable to serve on the board, but made it difficult for associations to operate with any level of efficiency. And I also believe that the legislature is maybe 2 or 3 years too late, recognizing that the ability to collect assessments is more important than they might have thought it was 3 years ago.
Correct. And as you say, Ken, they're a very reactive operation, for lack of a better word, and slow, but reactive, correct. And a lot of this is also due to term limits, and when you say it seems like they've gotten better, it is because of the education and the advocacy that we've been able to do that early on, say 3, 4, 5 years ago, there was a significant lack of understanding on how common interest ownership communities, what it means, how it works, what the dynamic is between a volunteer. Many members didn't even know that boards served as volunteer board of directors. So there was a lack of knowledge of how common interest ownership communities work, and so they figured, well, every little constituent request that came in, they knew best from Tallahassee, and they could run communities through 718 as just an umbrella. It's in 718. This is how you just simply look. It's a one glove fits all hand kind of approach. We were able to say, well, first of all, communities are very different. I mean, we have high rises, we have low rises. We have each community looks different, and the board, the volunteer board, knows best how to run it. So the biggest issue, I think, is just providing that education and advocacy on allowing the local community and the local board to manage their affairs.
I'm glad you put it that way, because one of the legislative trends that I think everybody in the room would like to see is a trend away from the legislature's apparent desire to micromanage every condo in the state and have a little bit of trust in the people who actually live there or are elected to run the place to make decisions on how to do it. I think condos are more micromanaged than municipalities and counties. Let me ask if we can move into, we'll discuss what call is. And it's important that you check it out and inform yourself. We've discussed the types of surveys that we do and how they provide us a powerful microphone to speak through when we talk to the legislature. And Travis, who has a unique insight because this is what he lives to do, to tell us what is going on in Tallahassee and what it's like to deal with the people there and try to move this huge bureaucracy that is our legislature. What I'd like to move into, and by the way, if you have questions on those little slips, first of all, yes, I have my glasses. You can write as small as you want, but larger printing is appreciated. If you hold them up, someone will come around to collect them from you and get them to me. And I do want to get to your questions because I want to spend as much time as possible this morning dealing with what's on your mind. A quick discussion of the 2009 legislative session, and I guess it could be quick because Governor Crist saw to it that there wasn't much accomplished.
As Ken said, 2009 was most notable for what didn't happen rather than what did happen. Very briefly, there's probably only two noteworthy bills that actually did go through that might impact you. The first is a bill increasing foreclosure filing fees. Prior to this bill going through, your typical foreclosure filing fee to actually go down to the courthouse and for Bank of America to start the process to foreclose on a property, the charge was typically between $200 and $300.
So, David, in other words, as reticent as the banks were to move their foreclosures along, now they're even more reticent because it costs them more just to file the complaint.
There's a sliding scale, but for high-end properties, that the cost now is $1,900. Okay? Very briefly.
And that's up from what?
That's up from $200 to $300 range. So you can imagine we're already having trouble getting the banks to pursue these foreclosures, and now they have to cough up an extra $1,500 per property.
So I forgot to include the county clerk's office when I talked about the industries that are getting healthier on our backs.
Right. So that's a pretty important factor just because it has a trickle-down effect to you all. The second noteworthy piece of legislation that did go through, and for those few of you that actually live in homeowners associations, this whole concept of Florida-friendly landscaping, which you probably see, you're driving through a community and then all of a sudden you see somebody who's got a bunch of cactus and rocks in their yard. There was a bill that went through that basically makes it easier for an owner in an HOA to fight off any regulations saying that you can't have that type of landscaping. It's kind of an environmentally friendly thing. So since we don't have too many HOA folks here, I won't belabor that issue, but just know if you're on an HOA board and someone submits a request for landscaping and they're saying it's for environmental purposes, you definitely want to take that to your lawyer because you may not be able to enforce your own restrictions.
Or for those of you that have people who own lots with some landscaping and they start to look, like the way they started to look, and you start to complain about it, this is the response you're going to get. I've decided to go Florida friendly.
Right. Now, turning to what didn't happen in 2009, there were a host of community association bills that were filed, including a bill that Carl was active in drafting and supporting. None of them got through the House and the Senate, with the exception of one bill, which would have impacted community associations. It had some insurance tweaks, which we'll get into, because it has come back this year in a new bill. There was some additional good language in there that many of us would support, and it was ultimately vetoed by the governor. And the reason for the veto was this fire sprinkler issue, which we will dive into a little bit further later today. Basically, the governor vetoed the bill because there was a pushback of a deadline for certain condominiums to have to retrofit their buildings with fire sprinklers, and many of you are probably aware of this issue. It would have pushed the deadline back from 2014 to 2025, and Governor Crist vetoed it specifically for this purpose. Now, obviously, there's folks on both sides of this issue, but I think clearly looking at the reasons for the veto, it's the concern of any politicians who sign a bill like that that might push back a requirement to have a mandatory fire sprinkler retrofitting because, God forbid, if there was a major fire in a high-rise condominium in Miami Beach, it wouldn't take the media 30 seconds to figure out, well, wait a minute.
When's the last time we had a well-publicized fire in a high-rise anywhere in the state of Florida?
It's been a long time, and that's the argument.
Could it possibly have been the plumber's lobbyist?
It could have been the plumber's lobbyist, but I also think you have to look really strongly at the fact that, you know, Governor Crist didn't want... That, you know, he's running for Senate. The last thing he wants to have to deal with is a situation where there's a fire and someone points to the fact that, wait a minute, he pushed back a deadline. But again, I agree with you, Ken. That's sort of the policy reason behind the veto. If you look at some of the substance of it, there's a lot of people who are going to make a lot of money with this fire sprinkler retrofitting. So,
by the way, I think there is one salient point we neglected to make to everybody about the call website. What is it? What is the address?
I'm glad you asked that. You would think we would have hit on that, right? It's callbp.com. callbp.com. And we have some information in the back regarding call if you have any questions on that.
David, because we only have Travis for a short stint this morning, I want to move over to talk to Travis about his perspective on what happened in 2009, and just give people sort of a laundry list, if you will, because I want to, while we've got you here, talk about the Fasano bill, 1196, but I'd like people to at least have the numbers of the bills that we are tracking on call, so you will know which ones to look at, and just a brief blurb about what each of them is attempting to cover, if you can just give the list.
Sure, Ken. And real quick, one comment before I give that list. Just another group that Ken would not have really probably even remembered to have mentioned. It serves as an example of how there are special interests of all kinds. And something that happens every year, and call is in there addressing it, and it's something that you never see because it doesn't come up sometimes as a bill. And that's there's a group called, this is just an example of how the process works. There's a group called Pets and Condos. And every year, they talk to a legislator. And again, this is why it's important to make sure your legislators are hearing from you as well, because they're going to act on who they hear from. Pets and Condos, and they file a bill that says you're allowed to have, no matter what your guidelines or your restrictions may be in your community, that you, if you have a doctor, a nurse practitioner, a chiropractor, a friend that's a mental health care provider, I mean,
in some cases, it doesn't have affidavits.
Right. I mean, if you just basically say and have a note that says that in order to make you happy, you have to have a pet. It doesn't say what kind of pet. It doesn't say what size the pet is. Doesn't say how many of those pets.
Gary Polykoff aptly dubbed them prescription pets, the wonder drug of the 90s and the 21st
and
century.
Every year at this time, and I'm waiting for the call, and it happens every, no pun intended, and it happens every year right now, I will get a call from a legislator, and they will say, we need to meet with you because we want to file the pets and condo bill. And I have to go in and I have to explain, well, what happens if the snake that makes me happy eats the rat that makes David happy? And what, you know, it says you're allowed to have a bird to make you happy. Well, is that
careful,
a whole area of birds?
Careful talking about birds with Roger here.
But those are the types of things that, again, it's an issue where they just don't understand how common interest ownership works and the types of things people agree to.
What about the person that moves into a no-pets condo because they have a severe allergy to animal dander? What about their rights?
Correct. It's an issue that we explain, and it goes away because we say, well, you know, we'll work with you to make sure that that the language says that the board may adopt reasonable restrictions regarding size, weight, number, all of those kinds of things. So
how many of you are painfully well aware of what Travis is referring to, which is the fair housing laws that takes your no pets restriction and makes it like a piece of Swiss cheese? And we're happy to discuss that when we get to the Q&A session, and I appreciate you pointing that out, Travis, because it is important for everybody to know that that advocacy group is there at the gates of the Capitol every year trying to advocate for a legislation that will poke more holes into the into the cheese already.
And it's because of you and the relationships that we have with members and with legislators that, you know, they will call and they say, you know, can you come in and explain to us the other side of this? And that's what we then do. We go in and we say, well, you know, there's a balance here. And the communities have the reasonable avenues to put in restrictions and to put in, you know, those kinds of issues to deal with them. But to mention just some numbers.
numbers.
I got to tell a war story on that one. I'll take a minute, but it's worth it. Just so everybody understands the fact that we know this is the law, but we're every bit as cynical and skeptical as you are. I've been doing this 25 years. And about 5 years ago, I got an application from a woman named Dottie at a co-op because she wanted to keep her poodle there. And she had a doctor's note, a Florida physician wrote a letter on her behalf saying, Dottie lost her husband a few years ago, she's xenophobic, she never goes out, she's a shut-in, this is her only companion, she needs this animal prescribed or diagnoses her as having depression and that the dog alleviates the symptoms. And I was about to say to my client, this meets the standard. You have to let her have the dog. And that weekend, my mom and dad came down to visit us. And my mom's talking to me, and she says, by the way, you'll like to get a kick out of this. I've got a friend who was talking to me about putting one over on a co-op to bring in her poodle. And I said, really, Mom? She says, yeah, my friend Dottie is got a doctor's letter. And I said, really, what is it that she's putting over on her co-op association? She says, well, Dottie goes out every night. She has a very active life. She's at the beauty parlor 3 times a week for a manicure, a pedicure, her hair, her makeup. And at which point I say, Mom, what's Dottie's last name? So my first call on Monday morning was to Dottie's lawyer, and I think the expression was something about loose lips. So if you think that we don't share your cynicism about some of these statutes, I mean, let's face it. When the fair housing laws came out, nobody would object to somebody who was blind having a seeing eye dog, somebody who's hearing impaired having an assistance animal, and somebody who really has a legitimate need for an animal to have an assistance animal. How many of you grew up with pets or have pets? I did. So it is unfortunate that this statute that was intended to help the disadvantaged people of our society has been, if you pardon the expression, so twisted and perverted to basically vitiate your pet's rules. Because that's where it's headed. And this is what these advocacy groups would like to see happen. Anyway, Travis, I had to share the Dottie story.
The bills. The bills. The two bills that, and just quick history or civics lesson, actually. Because our legislature only technically runs 60 days, we have months of committee meetings leading up to that, but they actually do not vote in session. The regular session is 60 days long. A bill has to pass identically the House of Representatives and the Senate and then be signed by the governor, or if the governor does not veto it in an allotted amount of time, it becomes law without his signature. So because of the time, those bills are, you have to have a House companion and a Senate companion going through the process at the same time. So when we give you bill numbers, most often they are paired together as a House bill and a Senate bill. House bills are always odd numbers. So when you hear a number, sometimes if we don't put the, you know, HB in front of it, if we just say 115, you know, okay, that's House bill because it's odd. And this is information that a lot of members barely, I mean, it takes them like 3 years, I guess, to figure this stuff out. So you're getting stuff for free here. And Senate bill numbers are obviously always even. As David mentioned, in 2009, one of the bills that we were very, very, very involved in was Senate Bill 880. Now, don't write that down because I don't want you to get confused with numbers for this year. But just so you know, there was a bill, and there was a House bill as well that David mentioned dealing with insurance. I'm not going to give you a number now, but I just realized what I probably did by giving numbers that are old. Those bills did not pass. As David mentioned, in the case of the insurance bill, it passed the legislature, but was vetoed by the governor because it combined some other elements, such as the sprinkler retrofit piece. And the governor does not have line item veto authority except in the budget. So it's once the package goes to the governor's desk, and we do that all the time. We lump all kinds of things together so that the package is more attractive to be signed. This year, the bill that is the son of that 880, the one that you really need to remember, is 1196. Now, because that's an even number, it's a Senate bill. Senate Bill 1196.
And we're going to spend a good portion of the morning going through that bill with you.
And yes, Ken, Scott, and David, from the legal standpoint, can go through exactly the parameters of that bill and what they mean specifically, you know, on the street to you.
1196 is sponsored by Senator Fasano, Mike Fasano, out of from the West Coast. It's a very good sponsor to have because he's the president pro tem of the Senate. So he's right in there with the president's office determining committee references and help moving that bill through the process. The companion to that bill, and right now they are not identical.
We'll talk about that too.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about the fact that they have been filed, as is often the case, different, and then it is up to us to match them together, all of us working together through the process. That bill is 561. The House bill is 561 by Representative Ellen Bogdanoff from here, from the East Coast, but down further south in Broward County, Fort Lauderdale, a little bit of Palm Beach. But again, in a very heavy condo district, and so she understands, and also on the water, so she understands a lot of the issues that these communities, that your communities face.
Do you have, or David, or can you assist by just providing the bills we're not going to talk about this morning, some of the other bills that have been filed, just to give them the list and a very short blurb about what each is attempting to address so that they can know that there are other bills out there to monitor, because then I would like us to get into our discussion of Senate Bill 1196 so we can actually get into some substance.
Travis brings a good point. On our call website, we have all these bills listed. So you can actually go home if you want to and read some of these. We're going to, obviously we don't have time to go through all the bills here today. But with call, whenever these bills come out, we make a decision. Is it on the call A list? Is it on the call B list? Or are we just going to disregard it? Okay. Right now on the call A list, there's 25 bills. Okay. Now, it's debatable whether half of those really deserve to be on the A-list, but I'm going to kind of tell you the super A-list that we've got, and I'm just going to go through them very briefly.
2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
On the super A-list, there's about 13 bills. So do you want me to just list them out? Or okay. The first one is House Bill 115. This was followed by Representative Ambler, as well as Representative Rabina. Ambler is from the Tampa area. Rabina is from the Miami area. This is a big one that's 106 pages. It's got quite a bit of legislation in it. I think we will hit on this bill to some extent. There's some good things in here, some things that we have some concerns about. Bulk buyer legislation, new requirements in a condominium that you can only access a unit if you provide 24-hour notice and you go in with two representatives from the association. New requirements on board member delinquency, some of these things.
Lest any of you were wondering where some of the screwy things in the statute already were coming from, these names might be familiar to you.
So there's quite a bit there. It's 106 pages. Then let me just kind of move very quickly through the rest of them. SB 164. It addresses the statutory cap. That's when a bank foreclosure, when Bank of America forecloses on a property, as we all know, when they finally take title to foreclosure sale, they don't have to pay all the assessments. The amount of assessments they have to pay is capped. So we're going to refer to that as the statutory cap. SB 164 tweaks the statutory cap a little bit. HB 327, filed by Representative Rabina, that primarily deals with the issue of the bulk buyer purchase of a condominium. Again, another topic we'll get to in just a moment. Next is HB 329, filed by Representative Rabina. This contains similar provisions that you will see in HB 115. Next is HB 419, again, filed by Representative Rabina. This one is 175 pages, so we're going to dive into that bill a little bit, but some of the same issues coming up again. What's interesting about HB 419 is you don't typically see bills that address cooperatives very often. They're kind of left behind, and there's varying reasons for that. But this bill has quite a bit of legislation in it about cooperatives. So if any of you are in a cooperative or have any friends, they might want to read that bill. Travis mentioned HB 561 as well as SB 1196. In addition to those, you have SB 780, which addresses the statutory cap. You have SB 840, which addresses this bulk buyer situation we'll talk about in a moment. SB 968. SB 968 basically talks about if unit owners are going to lose rights, you know, if a bill goes through that says that you lose certain rights if you're delinquent in the payment of your assessments, you have to provide an additional notice period before you can take those rights away. That's basically what SB 968 says in a nutshell. And then we've had a couple of files here in the last few days. And that's one thing I did want to mention. Of these, the 25 bills on the call A list, the vast majority of them have been filed in the last 2 weeks. So this is really now the time where all the bills are being filed. The last three I'll mention is SB 1222, which is a companion bill to HB 561. SB 1270, which addresses this fire sprinkler issue. And then finally, SB 1272, that further addresses the statutory cap. Two provisions that are interesting in SB 1272. In a condo, as you all probably know, the statutory cap is the lesser of 6 months unpaid assessments or 1% of the original debt. For some reason, in an HOA, it's 12 months or 1%. One thing that SB 1272 would do would be to make the 6 months in condos, the six-month cap, make it 12 months. It would also require the bank, during the pendency of the foreclosure, to pay any special assessments. So, some relief there. What's that? Special assessments.
Only the special or regular
monthly? Only
the special. Only special assessments levied for a particular purpose.
For a particular purpose. And again, this one was just filed literally 48 hours ago, but I believe it's just special assessments for a particular purpose.
What the bill really did was require them to be liable for special assessments that were levied for casualty losses, where you had to levy special assessment to cover your deductible for uninsured losses.
Two quick just process things. As David mentioned, now is the time when all of these are being drafted and filed. The deadline to file a new bill is noon on the first day of session, which would be Tuesday, March 1st. So right now, you're going to be seeing between now and through the month of February and through that day on March 1st. Now it's a very good time to be paying attention to that website. And then all the bills that are going to be in play will be there. Obviously, the mandatory process then starts. And then the second item is, you hear a lot of these things, there's a lot of similar pieces in various bills. Because, you know, obviously you want to get your piece, say bulk wire, that the homeowner, home builders are working very diligently on. You want to get it in as many trains as you can. Because what ends up happening is we sit down with legislative leadership. They say, okay, these issues are out. We're not dealing with these, you know, financial disclosure for board members and those kinds of things. No, that's done. We're not dealing with that. Here are the issues we are going to deal with, and they'll pick a vehicle. They'll just pick one. They'll say 1196, that's going to be the bill we're going to pass this year in the Senate, and we'll match that up with a House bill. And so then all of the, you know, the pieces that, you know, this piece is in four different bills, that will take, and we put it all together into a package. So it's very important to stay on that website, because it becomes a game of kind of tracking where the issues are and what train it is that eventually leaves the station.
In other words, it's confusing.
Correct. And it's done purposefully, and that the process is done for whatever reason. It's not made to be orderly, and it's just the nature of the beast, and so you've really got to stay on top of it.
One thing I did want to mention as well is you're probably saying to yourself, that's a lot to track and a lot of work, okay? And I can assure you it is. What we try to do at CALL is to take all that information, summarize it, and that's part of our process of educating you is through these call alerts that we send out via email. And one feature we're going to add here shortly is Travis is going to basically give more periodic updates on what's actually going on in Tallahassee. And we're going to create a blog that will allow Travis to communicate sort of up to the very moment things are happening so you can get that information and remain educated. So that's kind of a sneak preview of Travis's blog, which will be happening here. Yeah, tweeting, twittering, Facebooking, whatever else it is, but we will be blogging here at Call Shortly. So
I pulled a couple questions out just for a little bit of an interlude. Scott, I guess I'll direct this first one to you. We all know the Condo Act says that a lien is only good for a year from the date it's recorded unless it's extended because of the filing of a bankruptcy, and then it's extended until after the expiration of the automatic stay. A condo here in Melbourne has documents that state no lien shall continue for more than a year after it was recorded unless action is taken to enforce. Well, that's consistent with the Condo Act, and it is currently legal. But the question is, what does action to enforce the lien really mean?
It means you got to foreclose that lien. You got to file a lawsuit. And then you get to come to me, because I'm a litigator. So I hope to see you on a jury soon. First things first, though, I got a traffic ticket on the way over here, so how many people think I'm going to fight that? Ken, I'm going to expect you to let me put that on my expense report this month as well.
Good luck.
You got foreclosure lien. I mean, I would like to congratulate you all, first of all. Brevard County, I think, now is in the top five in foreclosures. So, congratulations. In the state. There's actually, there's somebody that came out with a survey that said that Brevard County, based on per capita and the amount of properties and the amount of people, however you skew the numbers, you're actually in the top two. There's basically, in, you know, the real estate boom was pretty big over here, and there was a lot of condos constructed. So now I spend a lot of my time going to this place called Vieira, which I don't know what Vieira was about 10 years ago, but now it's quite the metropolis, and that's where the courthouse is. So yeah, you've got to foreclose out that lien. Like you say, it's only good for a year. You got to foreclose the lien.
The last part of this question was this: if you have a chronic non-payer, what's the best way to get his or her attention?
You put the lien
in 100 words or less.
I'm a litigator. That's hard. What's a lien on?
Right, fair enough. As a litigator, we know what your perspective would be.
I understand you want to work a payment plan. You know what? Put the lien on and then work a payment plan.
I think it's important for everybody, as we talk about these different collection techniques that will become available to you or may become available to you, or whether or not they should become available to you, turning off the cable, denying the access, making them wait in the guest lane to get out of the community, suspending their voting rights, denying them access to the common areas. What is the goal of the collection process, lest we all forget? The goal is to get paid. And now I realize when that goal realistically cannot be fulfilled, you search for other ways just to turn that screw a little bit and to make sure your owners get the visceral satisfaction of just giving them a little bit of a twist of the needle. But the goal in legislation and the goal in the way you devise your collection policies for your community and the goal in which you pursue even a chronic late payer, sir, should be based upon the best way to get you paid. Now, what does that mean in plain English? What would I recommend to a client if you have a chronic late payer? Well, I assume a chronic late payer is a guy who ultimately is a payer. So what do you do to get someone's attention when they're a chronic late payer? In most of your documents, among your remedies is a paragraph in your bylaws or your declaration that says if someone is more than 20 days delinquent, you have the right to accelerate. What that means in plain English is that if you're on a calendar year fiscal year, and we're in January, your budget, current budget, is in effect till the end of this year. And if you have a late payer and you have the right to accelerate in your documents, you can send them a notice to say not only are you late, not only are you going to pay, but you're going to pay through December of this year, and we'll see you in 2011. How many times do you think you'll need to do that to get the person's attention and everybody else's attention? One of the other questions we got, and it deals with legislation, Travis, that is being considered now, is how we feel about the non-judicial foreclosure proposals that are being made. Now, you and I have spoken about it briefly, and you know I've spoken with some of the other people on the Florida Bar Committee about this. What is non-judicial foreclosure? It means that the banks will set up their own forum outside the purview of the courts through which they will prosecute their foreclosure actions. What are your thoughts on it, Travis?
initially, that proposal came because we were been talking to the banks for a couple of years now, and the banks were dragging their feet and providing us with nothing. So they've come up now, as Ken mentioned, with a proposal. Again, it's not filed as anything yet, but they came up with a draft 3-4 weeks ago and said, run this by your client and the people that you represent, and tell us what you think about this non-judicial foreclosure process. I think, and as I think Scott would also agree, I think it takes the teeth, in looking at it, it takes the teeth out of the major tool, in fact, of the hammer, out of the process. And it also, it's forcing the community to go through a process without really any guidance. It would be my concern, and I know from a technical standpoint.
Isn't one of the dilemmas with the current system that as community associations, we have so little control over the speed with which the banks foreclose, and the banks have the ability to engineer or manipulate, if you will, the process so that they can foreclose at their own pace, and most of them are foreclosing at a pace that is designed to have them acquire the units at a point where they hope the market comes back. Would non-judicial foreclosure give us more control over the process or less control?
I think it would be less. And again, we were on that issue, and as you've honed into me so many times, we're maintaining the asset for the bank. We're maintaining.
Oh, I'm going to hammer that plenty this morning.
Okay,
I'm going to hammer that point plenty.
And again, we would have less control over the process.
Scott, do you have an opinion, or do you agree with what's been said?
I do. I know the judges don't like to see these foreclosures on their docket, and I know the dockets are just full of foreclosures. But at the end of the day, you under the Florida Constitution have an access. Everybody has access to the court system, and the best way to get those assessments made is to continue with your foreclosure process. Now, the bank may start their foreclosure process 3 years after you. I mean, you can't wait around. Well, the bank's probably going to file their foreclosure, too. They may not. They may just sit around and work something out with the homeowner a year from now. You've got to go in. You've got to foreclose out your lien. You've got to get paid. And somebody walking into the courthouse, they're going to cut a payment plan pretty quick when they know that judge is setting their house to be sold 30 days from the hearing.
Well, I realize it's almost a law school type discussion, but it bears repeating the point that you made about access to the courts, because let us not lose sight of what a foreclosure action is, and everybody here is a property owner, and some of you may still have mortgages on your property, and a mortgage foreclosure is a process by which the lender that has a lien on your property takes your property away. And I'd like to know that if that's ever going to happen to me or to any of my clients, they're going to be entitled to due process. And due process doesn't mean that you go to a forum that was set up by the lending industry for the lending industry. It's like those of you who have construction contracts with the Monsanto company. Anybody ever heard of them? Their construction contracts all say that in the event of any dispute, the dispute has to be arbitrated, and the arbitration is binding, and the site for the arbitration is a specific city in New Jersey. Would you like to guess what state Monsanto is located in? Would you like to guess what city they're located in? And would you like to guess what percentage of the population of that city is employed by Monsanto? So that's where you have to go to arbitrate. I don't think that's due process. So I think there's an entitlement on that issue as well.
Well, it sounds to me like this law requiring judicial a judgment to foreclose is something that the trial lawyers was through to make their laws a little better.
Well, there has to be some process by which a lender exercises its rights when you go into default, whether it be the association for assessments or whether it be the bank for the mortgage. There has to be a process that requires you to prove your rights, to document them, and to give the property owner who's going to be foreclosed the opportunity to mount the defense or at least receive the benefit of due process. So but my principal concern in the current economic climate, and believe it or not, some of the stuff we're trying to do, sir, will take money out of lawyers' pockets. If we can get the banks to be responsible for a lot more of the assessments, or frankly for all of the assessments, what happens to the collection business for community associations and managers and their lawyers? It virtually vanishes. But the benefit is you guys have cash. And I'm happy to give up that income to have you have the cash to do better things with your legal dollar, like have your lawyer look at the contracts you're about to sign or help you with regulatory issues and help you chase deadbeats. I would love to see that day come. I'm glad to give up that part of my practice.
Hey, can I just say one thing? If the legislature sets up some mamby-pamby mediation process for foreclosures that, okay, get out of court system, go to this work-it-out session, you know, if you're going to have to go through a whole litigation thing through this work-it-out session where you go and try to resolve this foreclosure, and then I guarantee you, if it doesn't work out, then you got to go appeal to the court system. So it'll be like going through a whole separate process that the homeowner can manipulate to stay in their house while all the neighbors keep paying, and then they can maybe stretch it out even further by appealing to the court system.
David, I was handed a question. What is the best way to handle an abandoned unit? You try to communicate with them, and mail comes back, move, no forwarding address. What's the best way to deal with that? I assume some of you have units that have been abandoned or were never even occupied in the first place. Fair assumption? David?
In that situation, what option would be for you as an association, and again, we're assuming you're not getting paid your assessments, which if the unit is abandoned, I think that's a pretty safe assumption. But if you're not getting paid your assessments and the unit is abandoned, one very practical option is for you all to pursue a foreclosure where you're the plaintiff. Even if there is another bank foreclosure lawsuit going on where Bank of America is the plaintiff, you all have the right to pursue your own foreclosure. And the good news is, when you are the plaintiff, your lawyer calls the shots on how quickly that foreclosure case is accelerated. And I can bet you, if you call me and you say, we've got an abandoned unit here, we want to process quickly, the bank's taking forever, I will get that lawsuit filed, I will get the first available hearing time, and we will go as quickly as the court system will allow us. The goal being, you will eventually take title. And when you take title, you then, in most situations, will have the ability to rent out the units and take some of those rental proceeds to pay some of these assessments. Now,
David, discuss for a second, though, the practical reality of an abandoned unit. I mean, it's January, it's nice outside. But what do we do with an abandoned unit in June, July, and August where FPL's turned off the power, or where the neighbors can see the cockroaches crawling out from under the door, or where we know the unit is deteriorating? What do we do? While the bank is sitting there, I know you're going to say, as Scott would say, we send a letter to the bank's foreclosure council and say, hey guys, something's happening to your property. You need to get somebody out here, access the unit, do something to preserve it. Scott, what's the typical response to that inquiry?
Do you get a response from the bank?
No, thank you. Back to David. That's what I figured.
We'll get to it.
The banks are in no hurry to take possession and control of the property because it comes at a cost. So, David, what do we tell our association boards that they can or should do with an abandoned unit that is not just abandoned but is deteriorating?
Well, the reality is, in that situation, you've got to do something, because you can't sit by, and if you have concerns about mold that could be deteriorating the common elements, one thing too we haven't mentioned is safety concerns. I mean, if you have enough units in your condominium that are abandoned, you're potentially on the brink of having a serious crime issue as well. So what do? You have to do something, and typically what you do is you go in there and you take care of the problem and you preserve the asset, which is the condominium, and the bank smiles from their offices because they didn't pay a dollar, and you've now paid all this money to get the condo cleaned up, in some instances to get the electricity turned back on so that you don't have this mold problem. And again, you all are spending the money to do this. And are you going to get that money back? If the bank forecloses and takes title, you're likely not going to get that money back. So
let's take a specific example, though, because you get this call just like I do. The unit's been abandoned. It's June, July, August. FPL's turned off the power. What do we do? If FPL doesn't get paid, they don't leave the electricity on. The association is not obligated in any set of documents I've ever seen to maintain the unit interiors or to maintain a separate utility account for the units. However, there is an implicit obligation. I'm glad you put it that way, sir, because what I say to my boards, and David, I'm sure it's the same thing you say, is say, well, if you don't have the power put back on, what's going to happen to the units? It's going to turn into a science project. It really is. And what is the cost going to be to remediate the mold infestation? $12,000, $20,000, $25,000, God only knows. And who's going to pay for that? Who's going to pay for that? Who's going to pay for that mold remediation? You can wait for the bank to come along and foreclose, but in the meantime, that mold infestation is going to do what?
It's going to spread. You're going to have issues with the common elements. And at the end of the day, and this is going to be unfortunately...
And neighboring units.
It's going to be a theme throughout our presentation here today. And that is, at the end of the day, when there's a problem that has to ultimately be remedied, you all are going to end up footing the bill. You know, that's the problem right now with 2010 in Florida and condominiums is real-life people, as I call them, real-life people who actually live in these places are subsidizing the folks that left a year ago. And they're subsidizing the banks who are holding on to their mortgage and not foreclosing, hoping that in 2 years the market turns.
Well, if we're going to have to foot the bill, what is, and we talked about the cost for mold remediation, what does it typically cost to set the AC at 78 for the month while the owner's delinquent, or while the owner's gone, or the unit's abandoned? I mean, you don't have to answer that even. That's a rhetorical question.
Right.
Even if it takes 2 years for the bank to foreclose, and you're going to foot the bill, what would you rather foot the bill for? $70-$80 a month to keep it air-conditioned, or $25,000 to remediate mold?
The other real concern is the unit next door. You know, Betty Smith lives there, and I hope we don't have any Betty Smiths here, but Betty Smith lives there. She's 92 years old, and all of a sudden she develops a respiratory issue, and she hires an attorney, and the attorney realizes the unit next door is abandoned, and oh, guess what? They found mold. Then you're looking at some serious issues.
The gentleman in the back asked if the association had an obligation to keep the power on. And there's nothing in the statute that specifically addresses that. But based upon what you just heard, don't you feel that as a board you have some obligation to respond to a problem that is not going to remain contained to an individual unit and is going to spread to other units? The unfortunate answer to that question is, yeah. Because as long as the problem is contained within that unit, shame on you, unit owner. But once the problem spreads to neighboring units or to the common elements, now you have to explain yourselves as board members. You know, sir, I got a condo that I represent in Indian River County where they are owned lots. The seawall is collapsing. The seawall happens to be the maintenance responsibility of the individual owners. Because the seawall is not functioning, the sod is seeping out from underneath the bottom of the seawall, so the lawn is collapsing. The owners abandoned the place. The bank has shown no interest in foreclosing. Same thing with your question about the air conditioning, sir. It is a very difficult pill to swallow to have an association look at having to spend what could be a significant amount of money to remediate a problem. What does it cost to get the air conditioning running? I don't know. It's something you have to take into consideration, but at some point you have to weigh that cost against what it will cost the community if you do nothing. And that is, unfortunately, folks, a business decision that is going to be your burden as board members to decide. And it is not an easy decision. I'm not here to suggest that there are clear-cut right and wrong answers, but I'm here to suggest that there are issues that you have to address. And with that, Travis, I think you need to go, so I want to thank you for coming. We appreciate your input. Travis, your email address for everyone concerned.
It is more, M-O-O-R-E, T, as in Travis, just all together, more T, at tampabay.rr.com. So if you've got questions as the process is moving along, or you say, hey, I ran into Senator Altman at Publix, and he said that I could come in and see him about a problem I was talking about. What's going on on a particular issue? Just send me a note and let me know. And again, I do have to run, and I apologize for that. I've got to go coach my daughter's under 12 girls soccer team. Not that they listen to me anyway. They like to have somebody on the sideline that looks official. So anyway, I've got to go do it. But thank you very much.
Thank you, Travis. Okay, with that, I'd like to intersperse some of your questions with a discussion of Senate Bill 1196, which is what we're calling, I think the correct term is the omnibus bill, for condos. And it's a bill which we've had a lot of input into. It's a bill that we hope will move this session. I want to start with one of the provisions in the Condo Act that is part of this bill that I have described to some of my clients as the stupidest piece of legislation I've ever seen. And that is 718.110, subparagraph 13. And for those of you that aren't aware of this provision, it's being addressed in this bill, and I want to make you aware of it, because if you're not aggravated with what the legislature has done by virtue of the discussion we've had so far, this is pretty much guaranteed to get you over the top. A couple of years ago, the Senate President, I think it was Mr. Senate President Kaine, introduced a bill to try to curtail your rights to restrict leasing. Now, how many of you would like to see your communities primarily run as an owner-occupied community? That was a predictable response. And how do you accomplish that objective? You put certain restrictions on leasing. You don't forbid it altogether, but you try to regulate it in such a way that people who would buy a unit solely for the purpose of leasing are discouraged. So, David, when 718.110.13 was amended into effect a few years ago, what did our friends in the legislature leave us with?
What they left us with is a situation where if you amend your leasing restrictions, that amendment is only effective against those that voted in favor of the amendment.
What if I don't vote at all?
If you don't vote at all, you're considered a no vote.
So what does that mean? Does that mean I'm bound by it, or I can still lease under the old restrictions?
You can still, if you're a no vote or you are apathetic and you didn't even show up, you can still lease under the old restrictions. But there's only two tiers of it. First,
before you go to the two tiers, sure. I want that to sink into everybody. Because every amendment you've ever done to your documents has impacted what segment, what portion of your community? All of them. Except for this. You now have a provision that says that if you get the two-thirds or 75% or whatever it is to amend, it only applies to the people who affirmatively voted for it. David, what does this mean in terms of record keeping for the community that conducted the vote?
It's absolutely critical, because I've seen this myself in my office, where a condominium client will come and they'll want us to litigate a leasing restriction. You know, leasing is one of the big three. Pets, parking, and leasing, okay? That's the big three. So leasing is one of the big three, and if you come to me and you say, you know, John Doe is violating our leasing restrictions, we amended this this provision 3 years ago, and he's violating it, the first thing I'm going to say to you is, well, did John Doe own 3 years ago? And if the answer is yes, I'm going to say, did he vote yes or no?
Statute became effective when?
In 2004, I believe.
October 1, 2004. So any amendment that you've done since then?
Correct.
And there's also been a case that addressed an attempt to do this through the rules.
Right.
That said, no, you can't.
Right. So that's why record keeping is absolutely critical. It's frustrating for you all to know that in 2005, if you adopted a leasing amendment, 30 years from now, if the laws didn't change, you're going to need to know how Unit 210 voted in 2005.
If it's still owned by the same person.
Right, if it's still. Now, that's the second tier of this. That leasing restriction becomes effective against those who voted in favor of it, and everyone who takes title after the amendment is effective. What does that mean when an amendment becomes effective? It becomes effective when it's actually recorded in your county's public records. So in this example here with John Doe, if your leasing amendment was recorded on July 1st, 2005, if John Doe purchased the unit in 2007, it's effective against John Doe, because John Doe purchased after the effective date of the amendment. But if Betty Smith has lived there since the beginning, and Betty Smith missed the annual meeting and just didn't vote in that 2005 amendment, then it's not effective against her.
How many of you were aware of this section of the statute before now?
No.
Aren't the rest of you glad to hear about it? By the way, when the bill was first proposed, Senator King wanted it to not only apply to leasing restrictions, he also wanted it to apply to pet restrictions and parking restrictions. So what that would mean is that the people who didn't vote for it could continue to have whatever pets may have been permitted under the prior version of your documents, or the people who didn't vote for it could continue to park commercial vehicles on there while everybody else couldn't. just think about how counterintuitive this is to the condominium concept. That the people who don't vote for the amendment get a free pass. The way to get grandfathered in is not to vote for it. Not to mention the fact that who operates a condo that has two classes of owners? One group that operates under one set of rules and one group that operates under another set of rules. Now you can understand why, for lack of a better description, I have characterized this as the stupidest piece of legislation I've ever seen. We have talked about trying to repeal it, but the political impetus to do it simply is not there yet. Any help you can provide by communicating with your legislators about how you feel about this piece of legislation and whether or not it's consistent with the way you want your condo to operate, we are more than welcome to hear it. But there's a slight tweak to it this year is what, David?
They're going to tweak it to basically minimize its impact. You know, as lawyers, we struggle with it because the way 718.110.13 is structured is we always have the debate, well, does this amendment impact leasing? And as I'm sure you can imagine, many amendments could arguably impact leasing. So what this provision will do is it minimizes it to amendments that specifically talk about the term of the lease. You know, let's say in your condo there's a 30-day minimum rental. Okay, if your amendment says we're going to make that a 90-day minimum rental, then under this provision, this proposed legislation, that would clearly be triggered as falling under the umbrella of this statute. So it's an attempt to really sort of shrink it down to just essential things that are impacted.
I want to intersperse a few questions. Is there any legislation being considered right now to force mortgage companies to pay condo fees? And I think to a certain extent you answered that by reviewing some of the bills, but discuss it for a little bit. I mean, we're going to come back to the policy aspects of that issue a little bit later.
Yes.
I can promise you we're going to come back to that.
Yeah. There are a few bills filed that would require banks to pay assessments or more assessments and also assessments during the pendency of the foreclosure. One of them is HB 329, which we talked about, filed by Representative Rabina. Basically, what this would require is within 30 days of filing the foreclosure lawsuit, the banks would have to pay 6 months of assessments to the association. Okay, so that would infuse some cash right at the get-go of the foreclosure. And there's also a provision in this bill which says that the bank has to complete its foreclosure within 1 year. And if it does not, it loses the protections of the statutory cap. And what that means is, in essence, you can demand all the assessments from the bank. So that bill, if that particular provision from that bill passes, that would be a big win for condominiums.
Let me pose a question sort of out of routine here, but who here believes that we're going to resolve your cash flow problems by any means other than requiring the banks to pay more? Because if you're here, I'd like to hear the analysis, because I haven't figured it out. Does that mean all of you agree that it's really the only way it's going to happen? Yes, ma'am. I'll repeat the question for everybody. Are you calling your lifeline? I'll come back to you in a second, ma'am. I want to interject a couple of questions, and we'll come back to the statute. We are considering changing cable service. Does this have to be a board decision, a resolution made, and a board vote? David?
Well, it's you're changing cable service. It depends on what your documents say. If you've got if it's clear that you have the power to have bulk cable in your complex, next thing you'd want to do as your lawyer, I'd want to look at your specific contract to make sure that you're...
Do what?
You can switch or terminate it. These cable contracts...
That's common in cable contracts?
It's very uncommon. When it comes to contracts, elevator folks and the cable folks have some of the most rock solid contracts I've ever seen.
It's like buying luggage. You have it for the rest of your life. You're with them forever. You cannot get rid of them. It's like laundry lease contracts, too, frankly.
The other thing, too, would be cable contracts and the elevator contracts. They are not afraid to unleash their full arsenal of attorneys in the event you try to mess with them at all.
And they've got more money than you.
So just know that going into it.
Well, but the other question I want to be clear on, David, is they said, does it have to be a board decision? I guess the question is, if you're here who wrote the question, are you saying is it a board decision or a membership decision? Are you a condominium? Well, but it's run out. It's run out, but it's also possible that it may have an automatic renewal clause. Well, in that case, if the contract is run out, you can cancel it. But decisions on these contracts, decisions in your community are always made by the board unless
the documents say otherwise.
And if the documents say otherwise, that means the documents require a membership vote. So you have to start with the assumption that at a minimum, the decision to terminate would be a board decision. It is unlikely on a cable contract or any service contract that your documents would require a membership vote. It's just not a typical provision. You also need to remember, for those of you that have a cable contract that was recently signed by the board, that the statute gives the owners an option to cancel it. At the first membership meeting after the contract is signed, whether or not it's on the agenda, an owner can make a motion to cancel the cable contract. It's sort of a veto the owners have if the board binds the community to a bulk contract. Another question I have, which is happening frequently, beg your pardon?
What if you decided to put a dish of satellite on the roof of the condo?
Yep.
What if the cable company is doing nip ups to give you a better deal?
Well, frankly, the more competitive and the more quality the satellite companies can deliver, the better it is for all of us, wouldn't you say? I mean, up until now, the franchise cable provider has had the benefit of being the only game in town. So anything that provides some competition for this service, to me, is a good thing. It's annual meeting season. I have a question that says, we didn't establish a quorum at our annual meeting. What is the next steps? What is the next step with regard to the vote that was to be taken regarding our audit and the funding of our reserves? David? They couldn't get a quorum at their annual meeting. Do they have to try to recall it, first of all?
Well, unless their documents, you know, have some wacky provision like that, if you don't have a quorum at the annual meeting, I mean, typically you don't have to recall. It might be a good idea to do that.
I've gotten calls. It's interesting. I've never gotten these questions before until this week. I had three calls this week from clients saying, when we mail out the second notice, we don't have enough candidates to have a contested election. We're not conducting any business or any votes. Do I have to mail out a proxy? Or can I just send out the notice? What do you think?
Well, I tend to be a conservative condo lawyer, so I tend to err on the side of...
You've learned from conservative condo lawyers.
Yes, exactly.
That was pretty much a lock.
Right. I would go ahead and send it out. I mean, what's your thought on that?
Well, you don't have to have an annual meeting if nobody wants to come. But it's my opinion that you have to make a bona fide effort to call one. And if you don't mail out a proxy, it's a fait accompli. You're not going to have enough people there if you combine persons and by proxy. I mean, how many of your owners are going to say, well, I didn't get a proxy. Let me pull my form off my computer because I've got the state form for proxies right here and I'm going to sign it and send it in. What are the odds of that happening? About as long as the odds of the Dolphins winning the Super Bowl this year. You have... Well, they didn't make the playoffs. They got no chance. I'm from Cincinnati. I've suffered longer than anybody. Kidding aside, folks, I think you have the obligation to make a good faith effort, and to insert a proxy into the mailer is your way of at least establishing a quorum so you can conduct a discussion.
However, the most important part of the question, David, is...
What about if the meeting calls for both justices?
I'm going to come to that right now, ma'am. Right. Because this question raised the two typical issues that you address at your annual meetings. The vote on whether or not to fulfill financial reporting requirements, which, by the way, depends on when your fiscal year is over, whether or not it's timely, but also your vote on reserves. Because, David, if they don't take a vote to waive the funding of reserves, what gets included in the monthly or quarterly assessment?
The reserves.
100% too.
Yeah.
Remember, folks, what is the board's discretion with regard to the funding of reserves?
The board, right, the board has the option to go to the members and let the members decide on reserves, but the board does not have the power on their own to say, this year we're just going to fund 30%, or not at all.
A budget is required to contain two components, operating and...
Reserves.
And the reserve budget that the board adopts, the board has zero discretion. It must provide for 100% funding. And the only way the funding is reduced, a lot of you may be under the misperception, and a lot of people I speak with are under the misperception, that the board, that the members vote on whether or not to budget for reserves. That is not the case. What is it that the members are voting to do?
Waive or reduce.
Right. The members are voting not to fund that part of the budget.
And that's an emotion brought forward by the members, not by the board.
At a board meeting, no. It has to be voted on by the members at a membership meeting. What is the purpose of this reserve schedule if so many communities vote to either waive the funding of it or reduce the funding of it? What is the purpose of the reserve schedule? It's a one-word answer. What am I looking for? What is the purpose? No, it's not about money. What is the purpose of having a reserve schedule attached to the budget? Why should it be there?
Accountability.
Close.
Security.
Disclosure. The purpose of a reserve schedule is so that everybody in the community knows what expenses are coming up, what the purpose of those expenses will be, the roof, the paving, the painting, the pool deck, the elevators, what have you. Everybody knows what the remaining useful life of that asset is. Everybody knows how much money you got in the account now. And most importantly, everybody knows how much money they're going to be assessed for if they don't fund this reserve. The purpose of the reserve schedule is disclosure. When you all ran, or those of you still running your businesses, don't you keep track of the capital expenditures that are coming your way in the next 4 or 5 years so you know when you're going to need a chunk of cash? That's the purpose of a reserve schedule in a condo, is disclosure. The members can vote whether or not to fund it, but they are entitled to know, and frankly they should know, and frankly they should want to know, what expenses are coming up. For some of them, it's so that they know when to get out. And what percentage of you in this community actually take an annual vote to waive or reduce reserves? How many of you are fully funded? For those of you who are fully funded, when's the last time you had an outside expert do a detailed reserve study for you to make sure your numbers are accurate? Now how many of you are certain that you're fully funded? That's the reserve analyst calling to make sure I publish his name. The audit reports. I'll come back to you in 1 second, ma'am. I'll come back to you in 1 second. David, would you address the what happens? We've addressed what happens if they don't vote on reserves. What if they don't vote on the audits or the financial reporting?
If they don't vote on that, depending on what your annual revenues are, the statute requires a certain level of financial report. Now, before we get to the statute, if your bylaws say you have to have an audit every year, you have to have an audit every year. So that's the first place you look, is your bylaws, your governing documents, to see if there's a designated level of financial reports to have every year. If it's not there, you go to the statute. Depending on the level of your annual revenues,
what are the current levels?
The current levels are from 0 to 100,000, 100,000 to 200, and then 200, 400, 400, and above.
And 0 to 100 is a statement of income and expenses.
Right.
Over 100 to 200 is a compilation. 200 to 400 is a review, and over 400 is an audit. And the vote to reduce your financial reporting requirements is required to occur when?
Well, at the annual meeting, or during the fiscal year.
The last part is the most important part of you. How many of you operate on a calendar year fiscal year? So your fiscal year for 2009 ended on December 31. How many of you have your annual meeting in January, February, or March? It is too late to vote now to reduce financial reporting requirements for 2009. It has to be before the end of the fiscal year for which the financial report is to be made. So at this annual meeting where they couldn't get a quorum, then they've been voting too late on financial reporting anyway.
Right, and also there's a law in place now that says you can't waive your financial reporting requirements for more than 3 consecutive years. So that's the other caveat there, and that law, I believe, went into effect in 2008. That law doesn't look backward in time. It looks forward in time. In other words, if you've waived for 10 years, you could still waive your financial reporting requirement in 2009. But if you continue to waive, 2009, 2010 is your last chance. 2011, you have to have the full financial report.
With my apologies to the CPAs in the room, you're all guaranteed once every 3 years that every condo that is a client of yours is going to pay you to do an audit now, whether they want one or not. And it's interesting for you to understand this. This change in the statute that prevents you from waiving an audit more than 2 years in a row, is it more than 2 years in a row?
Three years? You can't waive more than 3 years in a row.
Okay. So every 4 years, excuse me. The interesting thing about this amendment is the legislature is depriving who? Who is the legislature depriving of a choice here? Is it the board or is it the membership?
Membership.
I mean, if this isn't a board decision on whether or not to do an audit or whether or not to do a review or to reduce the financial reporting requirements, this is a decision that has to be made every year by the membership. So it is the members who are being deprived of the opportunity to decide that we had a slow year, we didn't do any major construction projects. We didn't fire the management company or anybody else. Why should we pay for an audit this year? Well, because the statute forces you to if you haven't done one in the last 3.
In other words, Ken, the legislature is protecting yourselves.
From yourself.
From yourselves.
God
protecting
forbid,
you from yourself.
God forbid you should be trusted to make this decision yourself. And while we're talking about this, David, one of the amendments in Senate Bill 1196, 718.111, Section 13, is changing, would propose to change these financial thresholds to be more realistic. Can you cover that for
us? Right there, that provision, the dollar amounts, the $400,000 and above, you have to do an audit. Those have been on the books. That number's been on the books for quite some time. And I think the new bill on the high end, I believe it's $800,000. So it basically takes those levels of finances, the dollar amounts, and it just increases them, which will have the effect of, if you're a condominium and your annual revenues are $600,000, right now you fall above the $400,000 threshold, which means you have to have an audit. But if these new provisions come through, raising it to $800,000, you wouldn't have to have the audit. You just have to have, I guess, the compilation.
And what's the real difference to the community of the difference between doing an audit or a review or a compilation or a statement of income and expenses? What's the real difference to you? Cost.
Those changes are not supported by FICPA. So until we get their support, they will not have it.
I want to go back to the section of the bill that is worth talking about, and it's an issue that I'm sure that is near and dear to the hearts of everybody in the room.
Which
bill? 1196. How many of you in this room have never received a request from an owner requesting the opportunity to inspect your records?
Never.
Never. How many of you have never received a request from your owners to inspect records that wasn't done for the sole purpose of harassing you and your manager? How many of you have at least one person in your community that wouldn't agree if you told them today was Saturday? By the way, the mission statement of our firm was to make sure there was at least one of those people in every community in Florida. And thank you very much. It's a job well done. We laugh about it, but it's a serious issue. I have people in the real estate business who want every mailing address and email address for everyone in the building. For what purpose? To solicit business. I have people in different types of business in the building. They do it for a friend, even. They want to get all the mailing addresses and email addresses. And I have people who have provided the association with their mobile phone or their off-site addresses up north. for emergency contact purposes. I have one where the guy works, you know, he works for the CIA, and he's at Langley in a classified meeting, and his phone's ringing, somebody from the association wanting to give him a spiel about who he should vote for the board, because they have to give him a cell phone. And his cell phone, if you asked him for a cell phone, he would probably say to you, I could give it to you, but I'd have to kill you, right? There's been some movement on this, David, recently on this issue. There's some last year, but there's some proposals in this year to further address the notion of digital information, et cetera. Can you talk about the proposal in 1196 to try to curtail this a little bit?
1196 would result in some of these things being excluded from the gamut of official records. I believe there's email addresses. I believe certain other personal information. I think the bill also talks about employee records. That's always a big issue. You know, how much you pay your manager and what the bonus of the manager was. Certain employee records might be withheld from official records. Of course, that issue I brought up with what did you pay your manager, you also have to look at that in terms of that's a financial record. So, you know, maybe if this bill goes through, you won't have the ability to review the manager's review, whether they did a good job this year, but will you still have the ability to find out how much the manager is paid? Probably, because you know, it depends on how the bill is worded in the end, but some of this sensitive personal information will no longer be accessible to anybody who asked to see it.
And a caveat is that if you give the information for the purpose of the association mailing you notice of meetings, then it's accessible. But many of you give the association alternate addresses or cell phone numbers for one reason and one reason only. If the water heater explodes in your unit or in the unit above yours, you'd like to be contacted. By the way, I think it bears mention sort of a tangent from this, David, but a few years ago the statute was amended to recognize that most people in this day and age do have email, and it's more expedient and less expensive than snail mail. So for those of you that haven't amended your bylaws to allow owners to allow for owners to be sent notices of the budget meeting and the annual meeting and other meetings by email, statute now allows it, but it's got to be in your bylaws. I think it's an important amendment. If you have a community of 200 units and 100 of them have email and are willing to accept notices by email, isn't that a distinct advantage to you? This change with regard to access to records, I think, is one of the more important ones, and frankly, one of the more timely ones that we've seen for a while. Scott, you'll like this one. I mean, since you got a speeding ticket, let's talk vehicles. It was speeding, right?
Yes.
All right.
Sort of. Allegedly.
Well, yeah, allegedly. You just can't escape being a litigator. It was the tailwind that you weren't aware of. Our condo documents do prohibit commercial vehicles. And then it says in parens or trucks. Well, whoever asked the question, do they prohibit trucks or not? Is there an effective legal definition for a commercial vehicle? I'll ask both of you to take a stab at that one.
No.
By the way, for those of you who pay a lawyer by the hour, that's what you want. On the one hand...
Who am I representing? Am I representing the guy with the commercial vehicle, or am I representing the association? Again, if it's vague, it's going to be left open to judicial interpretation. Which side of the bed did the judge pick up on that
thing? As a partner in the firm, I really like you to expound for the benefit of your clients.
Obviously, yes. I mean, if you have a restriction in your documents prohibits commercial vehicles, you need to enforce that restriction just like you do every restriction. So you put the owner on notice that he's violating the restriction, and then if you have to take a covenant enforcement action.
Yeah, but if the documents just say no commercial vehicles, how do you decide what is and what isn't? What guidance do we have? And David, feel free to chime in too. What guidance do we have? What things do we know are commercial vehicles beyond debate?
you know, Joe's Plumbing with the ladder attached to the side, and God only knows how much equipment attached to the top of the van, you know, that's clearly going to fall into a commercial vehicle. But one option that some boards may want to consider, if amending your documents isn't an option for whatever reason, maybe you have a high amendment threshold, one option is to have adopt a board resolution defining what a term is. Now, it's usually not as effective as amending that definition into your documents, but it does give you a little bit more teeth. So if you have a provision that just says commercial vehicles are not allowed, that's from your original declaration from 1977, and you need, you know, 75% of everyone to amend your declaration, and that's why you've had no amendments since 1977, one option may be to have the board adopt a resolution defining what commercial vehicle means. Now, again, not as effective as an amendment, but an option.
How much do you want to bet that the provision that says no commercial vehicles was written by the board without the assistance of
us
or a lawyer?
Right.
I mean, how hard is it, back to whoever asked the question, how hard is it to put into the document a commercial vehicle is a vehicle that has commercial lettering or logos on the side, or a vehicle that carries equipment visible from the outside of the vehicle? Isn't that what you really want to prohibit? I mean, the fact that I drive my car in connection with my business, or it's provided me by my company, nobody cares. What you care about is a vehicle that detracts from the residential character of your community. So say so. Say what vehicles you don't want to be there. Don't assume that there is some omnibus but easily discernible definition for commercial vehicles. One of the things that lawyers are ridiculed for mercilessly, and sometimes with justification, is for writing things in mumbo-jumbo legalese, using Latin. But I will tell you, the people who are most prone to use legalese and fancy words are the people who are drafting these things, whether they be managers or board members, without the assistance of counsel. Say in plain English what you want to prohibit with regard to vehicles. Commercial vehicles, as Scott pointed out, is pretty difficult to define. It's not that difficult, though, to define what it is that you want to prohibit. Let's come back to 1196. Let's see what kind of fun our legislature has in store for us this year. David, in 718.112.2d, there are some amendments with regard to eligibility for the board. The first of which is to try to make sense out of that provision that was added a year or so ago about if there's fewer candidates running than there are seats available. Can you talk about how the Fasano bill attempts to clarify that?
I believe in the Fasano bill, it says you're eligible for reappointment in that scenario, as opposed to the current wording. There's this gray area.
Well, the current wording is need not run for reelection.
Right.
And actually, the current wording uses the word automatically.
Right. So this would make you eligible for reappointment, but not automatically on the board. You know, this is a scenario, if you have a five-person board, three seats are up for election, and no one submits their notice of intent to be on the board, including those three board members whose terms are expiring, this is the situation that this provision will address.
But I got the question last week from a client to say, well, we have six seats up for election, and the reason they have six seats is because they're a nine-person board, they had three-year staggered terms, and they got tagged with that two-year staggered term amendment that came out in 08. So now they have six seats up this year, but they had four people put their names in. And two of the incumbents didn't put their names in, so I got a letter from a lawyer in the community. He says, well, either of the two incumbents who didn't put their name in has the right to claim a seat because they're automatically reappointed. And that is what the current statute says. What do you think? You agree?
I think that you are a professor of law at Nova Law School, and I think that's a great law school exam question for you in this next semester.
I'm not that mean to my students because I want people to take the course next year.
Right.
And I actually called the division to say, have you dealt with this? How do you feel about it? And the division's opinion is basically what you said before, which is that provision would only apply if no one puts their name in. But I still don't understand what it means to be, quote, automatically appointed. They may not want to run. I mean, this is the Shanghai rule, right?
suddenly you're in the Merchant Marine. You wake up and you're on a vessel in the Indian Ocean.
Well, what's another interesting issue, Ken, and I find this is coming up quite a bit, and that fact pattern I just went through, a five-person board, three board members are up for, their term is up at this annual meeting coming up in February 2010. One person submits their notice of intent to run, so that one person fills one of the spots. The other three current board members who didn't submit their notice of intent to run are now saying, well, I'm still on the board, but then you've got three of them for two spots.
How do you know whose seat the person who put his name in was running for? Her seat, her seat, her seat. How do we know?
You go back and review the official records as best you can, but it's probably not going to be clear. It's not going to be
evident. You put your name in to run for the board. You say, I'm running.
Right.
The next thing that has been added to the statute is with regard to eligibility for the board, which I actually find kind of silly, but I understand the logic behind it, is that if you're delinquent in the payment of your assessments, you can't be elected to the board. Why are you electing them? Who elects someone who's not paying? Well, it's a fair question. The gentleman is saying, you know, do you tell people who's in arrears? And technically, you're not allowed to publish what's called a deadbeats list. I know a lot of you would like to, but you're not allowed to publish a deadbeats list. And because of that, you've got to be very careful about the discussions you have at board meetings when you take a treasurer's report or a financial report. But The legislature amended the statute in 08 to create eligibility criteria for people who are delinquent. Can you discuss where we stand now and what this amendment would do?
Right, I believe the current language talks about delinquent in the payment of regular assessments. And I think this change in the bill, I think it's the one you're referring to, Ken, would mean if you're delinquent in the payment of regular assessments, special assessments, fines, you know, any other monetary obligation you have to the association, you would then no longer be eligible to serve on the board. So I think that's the one you're referring to.
Is there a time frame like 90 days?
There's a time frame. I believe this time frame is 90 days, if I'm not...
That'd be 90 days delinquent, yes.
90 days delinquent, and it's, again...
You're suspended until God knows when.
Right. And then at the same time, you're suspended. What happens with the board? Does the board then appoint someone to fill your spot, and then presto, the moment you pay your assessments, you're back on, and we kick that other person to the curb? So this bill, 1196, has some language in it to clarify some of the things you do in these situations.
It's worth mentioning that we also have this suspension notion for people who are charged with a crime involving the handling of association property. That they are suspended until they're cleared. Of course, I don't know who serves in the interim or who wants to serve an interim position. The other issue with eligibility for the board that everybody has so thoroughly enjoyed is this notion of requiring everybody who wants to serve on the board to sign a document that says, I've read it all, I've understood it all, I'm ready to go.
Right. Yeah, it's created quite a bit of controversy. You know, certainly it's minimized the potential pool of board members, for sure.
Yeah, you think?
Because, you know, anybody in their right mind takes a look at that, and they're gonna have a moment where they're going to say, all right, wait a minute, what am I getting myself into here? So this bill would change things. It would give you the option. Well, first of all, I believe it changes it from signing the certification form before you run to after you run, but it also gives you an out where you don't have to sign the form if you go to a class and learn about being a board member. I'm trying to recall if it...
It says anything about people who are appointed.
It still has... And one thing I do want to mention about 1196... There are quite a few changes to it, clarifications that are going to happen here very soon. Once the session gets underway, there's several amendments that are already in the works to tweak some of these things.
Let me ask a question on this point, just let me interject this. Folks, how many of your communities have a licensed community association manager? How many of your communities have an attorney on retainer? So, who thinks that it is
a prerequisite to serving on the board that you sign a paper that says something more than my members in my community want me to serve, I have good judgment, I'm an honorable guy, I'm going to try to do the best I can for the community. Instead, it requires you to sign a certificate that says, I've learned all there is to know about our documents and the statutes, and I've got it. I'm ready to go. Why is this required?
Because you know what? Managers have so many associations, they don't even have a chance to read the documents. They will ask you a question, they go like a deer in headlights.
Okay. Well, but when you ask your manager a question about property management, I would expect him not to look like a deer in the headlights.
Why?
Well, maybe I would. Maybe I'd be disappointed. But when you ask your manager a question about the law, he or she is entitled to look like a deer in headlights because that's what you ask a lawyer. But the question is, should this threshold test be there for people who want to serve on the board? I mean, what should the thresholds be? I mean, we'd like to think that everybody who puts their name in to serve on the board has an altruistic motive to serve the community for that heaping amount of money you get paid for taking this abuse. Ma'am.
I have a comment that you mentioned earlier, this requirement to sign a certification of high-volume condo, not to co-op, to date. If, as a manager, I don't have to sign anything saying that I'm familiar with Florida statutes, why should a board member have to say they're more educated and they know more?
You are making the point for me. I couldn't agree more. I mean, how many of you have just the Oklahoma land rush when you put out that notice of your election, who wants to run for the board, and they come out of the woodwork like there's gold in Memnar Hills, I want to be on the board. How many of you have that problem with too many people wanting to run? Why do you think that is? Well, this is an important consideration because if the law is going to be designed to discourage the most qualified and desirable people in communities from wanting to serve, who's going to serve? The guy that wouldn't agree that today is Saturday. And there's going to be no election because there's going to be nobody to oppose him. I mean, one of my favorite jokes that I heard at one of these meetings years and years ago is about the guy that goes to the doctor and the doctor says, I get really bad news. You got 6 months to live. And the guy wrings his hands and says, Doctor, there's so much more I want to do. Is there anything that I can do to prolong this? The doctor scratches his head and says, do you live in a condo? The guy says, as a matter of fact, I do. The doctor says, get yourself elected to the board. And the guy says, what's that going to do for my health? The doctor says, not a damn thing, but it'll be the longest 6 months you ever had in your life. And apropos of that point, I got a question here that says, in a condo association, if everybody resigns and no one wants to be an officer, what happens? Gentlemen?
Funny you should mention that because I got that very question 3 days ago from one of my clients. It was a 5-person board, and 3 of the board members have serious, serious health issues. They're not going to be able to run again in February at the annual meeting. And the other 2 have just had enough. So they basically said they're out, and we went through the process of what happens if everybody resigns. And the long and short of it is, when everyone resigns, any unit owner has the right to petition the court for an appointment of a receiver. And what does that mean? That really means you have an accountant-like person who comes in, runs your books, decides how much money they're going to pay themselves for the right to do all this.
They don't work for free, do they?
They don't work for free, and the court basically appoints them and, for all intents and purposes, rubber stamps whatever it is the receiver does. So you need to avoid that at all costs. So what I advised my client to do in that situation was, let's have a board meeting before the deadline of the notice of intent to run. Put out a bunch of flyers. Make it very clear to everyone this is a serious issue. Get everybody out there. I'm going to come to the meeting, and we're going to discuss why we need someone to step up and volunteer. Now, if you have a 5-person board, it doesn't mean you necessarily have to have 5 people who step up, but you really need to have at least 3. So that you can continue to operate the board and avoid the receiver and all of the whopping expenses that go with it. Yes, sir.
What does the receiver do then? Does he take all the assets and sell them?
No, he runs the association. You're confusing a receiver with a liquidator. The liquidator is someone who sells off the assets. It is possible that you might be headed toward a termination of your condominium, but a receiver is someone who basically steps in and is appointed by the court and supplants the board and runs the condominium as if he is or she is the board.
And 15 years or
however long it takes. However long it takes for someone to step up. I mean, see it through for a second, folks. If the community has a receiver appointed, the receiver doesn't get to unilaterally change the bylaws or change the declaration. It means that I'm appointed to run. I'm appointed to run this place because nobody stepped up. Next year, I got to give 60-day notice of the annual election. And if somebody wants to put their name in, thank God. Maybe someone during the course of the year volunteers and the receiver says, well, all right, I'm going to appoint the board and get the heck out of here. Or maybe I like this gravy train enough that I'm going to stay here and collect my fees each month. But once you do this, I'll come back to you in a second, sir. Once you do this, as David said, you are surrendering the control of your community. You are taking your right as unit owners to elect a board or your rights as unit owners to serve as board members and having an outside person who has no investment in your community run the community. Fairly serious consequence.
And you might ask yourself the question, well, how much? What's that really going to cost? I believe one of our Tampa clients had this happen to them, and the final tally for the year was $50,000. So,
and that was for the receiver.
That's for the receiver.
That doesn't include the manager that he hires, the accountant that he hires, the lawyer that he hires, the extra fees that he charges for different services that may be provided. He hires the landscape company. He hires the tree trimming company. He hires the pool company.
And if you're a 100-unit condo or a 1,000-unit condo, 100-unit condo, 500-unit condo, you do the math. 50,000 divided by 500. That's your tally.
Let us sort of run through some of the other provisions in 1196, and then I want to really open up. I want to spend at least the last hour or so that we're here talking about collection foreclosure and taking your questions. So let us run through, David and Scott, the balance of 1196 quickly. 718.115 has been amended to allow the associations to provide more than just bulk
cable. Technology advances and the statutes...
Actually, let me be clear. It hasn't been amended. It's proposed to be amended.
Proposed, right. As we all know, technology advances, it seems like almost on a weekly basis. The statutes don't evolve with technology. So this would allow... The provision that's currently in the law addresses bulk cable. This provision would address... It would include bulk internet service, other types of... services under that gamut of bulk cable so that it's clear to you all what steps you need to take. So just advancing with the times.
And I'm going to come back to 718.116 because there are some changes in here, but let's hit them quickly here now, and then we're going to discuss the broader policy issues in a few minutes. Management company fees would be allowed under this amendment. Why is that a good thing?
That's a good thing because right now there's a this is a big issue because management companies charge different amounts related to collection of unpaid assessments.
Okay. Which means you should be looking at your management contracts to make sure that whatever they're charging, you can collect it.
Right. It's very stressful for the attorney when we get a ledger from a client and it says $1,000 assessment, late fees, interest, and there's a management processing charge on there. Maybe it's $50, sometimes it's $100. I know one management company that will remain nameless that charges $300, okay? The lawyer then has to say to themselves, is this a valid expense that I can lien for? Why are we so worried about that? We're worried about that because there's this little thing called the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act, okay? And basically, that law, that federal law, says that if we attempt to collect a debt that we know we shouldn't have, we've got a problem.
Tell them why we're really worried about it.
Well, we're also worried about it because it creates a very sticky situation where I may have to advise the client that $50, that $75 management company fee, I've reviewed your documents, and I don't think you can get paid for that, so I'm not going to risk putting it in my lien.
And now you've made an enemy of who?
The management company's not real happy about that because now they know that Becker and Polycoff or whoever the law firm isn't going to lien for that amount, and it creates an issue. So this bill will clarify that management company fees for certain actions up to $75 can be included in a lien, even if your governing documents don't specifically state that.
The next issue, I'm sorry.
For action or for all the actions that the management company might have done?
The current draft says that the management company can charge a fee up to, I believe, $75 for the letters, but I think it also says that if they provide the notices that are required by the chapter, they can charge a fee for those as well, as long as it's a, quote, a reasonable fee like an estoppel. Everybody knows an estoppel is a letter that goes out to a potential buyer. It says this is what's owed on the unit. And if the buyer pays it, you can't come back after the closing and say, oh, by the way, we forgot this special assessment. You are estopped. That's why it's called an estoppel letter. Let's talk about rent. Scott, how many times have you been involved in a foreclosure case where the association has said to you, how do we grab the rent from this unit?
It depends on the court. It depends on the judge. But generally what we can do is file a motion to have the rental proceeds deposited into the court registry during the pendency of the action. Now, that's probably going to be successful if the association is the one that's foreclosing. Correct me if I'm wrong, but if the mortgage company is foreclosing, you can't do that. The mortgage company is going to have a chance to get those rental proceeds first.
But let's talk about that for a second. First of all, perhaps the greatest insult of all is when the unit owner's not paying and he's got a tenant that they're paying him rent. That's pretty tough to take, isn't it?
Yeah.
You have a unit that is not paying you that is generating revenue, which, by the way, is uncommon in this market. What possible reason would you have to sit still and do nothing when there's money being generated by the unit? Well, you say, may say, well, the bank's foreclosing. Why should we spend the money? These are very tough choices in this economy. It used to be so much easier when everybody had equity, wasn't it? And now, nobody's got equity, except the people who are here and the people who are paying. The number of unit owners, the percentage of owners who are delinquent to your associations right now that have any equity in their unit is how much?
Zero.
Single digits at most. So you are faced with the choice between fairly unappetizing options. And the essence of those options, Scott, is do nothing, which is an option. It means you don't spend any money. Doing nothing is an option. But Scott, what happens if you do nothing?
Then it sends the message that you're not going to collect for any unpaid assessments in the building. It's a bad, bad message to send. You need to act uniformly and go after the assessments. Don't think the bank is just going to take it over at some point. These banks are moving slow. They don't want to pay these assessments.
There has to be a consequence to non-payment.
Absolutely.
So one option is to do nothing, but it means you're going to get nothing. And it also means that your word is going to get out and suggest to other people that maybe they should stop paying too.
Right, and if that happens, I mean, you know, the word that was brought up earlier, a scary word, is called receiver. You know, some of these investment condominiums down in South Florida have had receivers appointed. The delinquencies have been so bad. And then some of our clients, the condominiums here locally that have those type of condominiums say, you know what, why don't we, everybody's doing the receiver thing. Let's do the receiver thing. Are you out of your mind? I mean, literally, you would lose all control there.
Well, wouldn't you agree, though, there are circumstances where doing nothing is, frankly, the only viable option?
Yeah.
The units have been stripped. The units abandoned. The cost to make it rentable would be another $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000. The bank is foreclosing. The bank is owed $200,000. The unit's worth, on a good day, $125,000. You're going to foreclose on this unit. What can you possibly hope to get?
The headache.
That's a good answer. I mean, that's a fairly desperate situation, but that situation exists around the state right now with a lot of these units. And in that situation, you may have to resign yourself to the fact that there's just nothing we can do, and we're not going to throw more money at it. But what you have to look at, and as Scott pointed out when we talked about the receivership, is if you have a unit that is either rented or a unit that is in a condition where it is rentable, you have an opportunity to extract income from that unit. Is it a gamble? Is it guaranteed you're going to get the money? Of course not. But it's guaranteed that if you do nothing, you're going to get
nothing. One thing, Ken, I did want to mention. Every seminar I do where we discuss foreclosures and collection issues, I always like to bring this up because I don't think enough associations are doing this. Whether you have 3 or 40 delinquencies you're dealing with, schedule a 30-minute to an hour meeting with your attorney just to sit down and go through the files, because it's not paint by numbers. You know, you're not going to ignore every single delinquency, and you may not go after a full bore every single delinquency. Depending on the circumstances of the case, you may just ignore this one for 6 months, while this one you may want to go after and do everything you can do. You're not going to know that until you have the sit-down meeting with your attorney. So for those of you, you know, represented by Becker and Polykoff, you know, schedule a meeting with Scott or, you know, Keith Bull, our office here in Melbourne, sit down, talk to them for 30 minutes, get a game plan. And if you do that once every 6 months or once a year, at least you can have that dialogue so that we can have these conversations. Because I think one problem is folks are getting, you're hearing all this, a lot of it's confusing, it's a depressing time, but depending on the circumstances, there are things we can do. And in a lot of situations, with utilizing some of these techniques, you can get full payment.
Let's have some of that discussion right now. What are the circumstances under which you should take some action? I mean, the goal right now, let's, again, when people had equity, the decision-making process on collections was simple. Record, make your demand, record your claim of lien, make your final demand, file your foreclosure, and go, 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 until either the owner files for bankruptcy or the bank files a foreclosure. Because when there was equity, the banks were all too happy to expedite their foreclosures and take an asset that they were going to be able to turn around and make a profit on. They didn't mind having that in their REO portfolio. But now the decision is much more difficult. Because virtually any time you are faced with a decision to foreclose, you are foreclosing on an asset that has no discernible value to you in terms of the fair market value of the property being in excess of the first mortgage. So under what circumstances should you seriously consider filing an action? Under what circumstances should you? I mean, you're going to have this conversation, Scott. Keith's going to have the conversation. David, you've had it. I've had it 1,000 times. What do you look for? What are the indicators that should say to this board, we really should consider doing something instead of nothing?
I think equity in the unit is so tough to figure out, though, these days. I think the first thing is the bank foreclosing? If the bank's foreclosing, I would say there's probably little you can do.
Let's stop there. We've got a lot of units right now. How many of you have units in your communities where the bank is foreclosing? I would dare say pretty much all of you.
Well,
but the bank foreclosing used to be a death knell to us filing a foreclosure. But what if the bank foreclosure, okay, but yes, the bank's foreclosing, well, when did the bank file? December of 2007. Have you tried to reach the bank's lawyer? Yeah, they won't respond.
Another thing is, you're named as a defendant. Your association is named as a defendant. You could potentially cross-claim against the unit owner. You can go. Remember, the unit owner is indebted to you personally, as well as their unit having the collateral. You could go after and try a cross-claim. Speed up the foreclosure action of the bank by aggressively litigating a cross-claim or your defenses.
But does the pendency of a bank foreclosure still mean axiomatically that we're not going to file a foreclosure?
No.
And the reason for that, Bill, why? Because the unit may be able to
produce income.
Because the unit may be able to produce income, and if the bank isn't willing to get off its derriere and take possession and control and get some benefit from the income producing potential of the property, then why shouldn't we? Because otherwise you're going to get
nothing.
And you're going to wait. Those don't sound like good options. I'll come to you in a second, ma'am. I'll come to you in a second. Well, you'll get a legal bill if you spend the money. But the question is, if you're going to spend the money, you'll get a management bill, too. So there. So touche.
You know, Ken, one other example that came up in my practice this week is...
This is what I think is the heck of.
We have a very problematic unit owner who is constantly violating the governing documents. Okay, constantly. He's run into some financial problems, and we've already secured the lien. And in that situation, even though there is a bank foreclosure going on, my client has instructed me, as soon as the first opportunity comes about to file that foreclosure lawsuit, you do it, and then make it your top priority and move as quickly as possible.
Bingo. That's the second one.
Because if you have a problematic owner who's not paying their mortgage, not paying you, and continuing to wreak havoc in your association, the best, most cost-effective way to get them out of there is to spend your money on a foreclosure lawsuit. You, as the association, take title, and then you evict them.
If
you
one of
bring the sheriff, and they literally take their items, and they put it on the side of
the road. What are the odds? I mean, this is the second circumstance. Can the unit produce income? Because if it can, and this is not guaranteed, but if you believe it can produce income because there is a tenant there, or the unit is furnished, or it is habitable and could produce income, then you have a shot of putting someone in there and generating some revenue while the bank is sitting on its hands. You file, well, first of all, under the current law, you would file a you file your foreclosure, and you ask the court to appoint a receiver. And if the court appoints a receiver and the receiver puts a tenant in there, what should you do with your foreclosure? You want my opinion? Not a damn thing. Sit on it and collect the rent for as long as you can. If you file a foreclosure, file a motion to appoint a receiver, you get a receiver appointed, he either starts collecting rent from the tenant that's in there, or he finds you a tenant and puts the tenant in the unit, I'd sit on that foreclosure until the money dries up. Why not? Why not play the same game the banks are playing? And frankly, I even think there's a basis to file a motion in a bank's foreclosure for a receiver. To say to the judge, this foreclosure's been sitting for 2 years, the property is deteriorating, we had to turn on the power and pay for it out of our pockets to prevent a mold infestation, the owner has never come back, the bank has not even sent someone to the property to change the locks or safeguard it, it's being used as a crack den, God knows what else. We've written to the bank 14 times in the last 24 months to say this is going on at the property, they won't even give us the courtesy of a response. Judge, do something to protect the collateral for the benefit of everybody involved. I like that argument, by the way. I think it's a pretty compelling argument. And I would like to think that most of you would look at one of your local judges and expect the judge to say, I need to do something for the benefit of the community that I serve. Which means I've got to protect this property and prevent the bank from running it, turning into a science project, or worse. So there are things you can do if, as Bill correctly points out, you believe the unit can produce revenue, and as David correctly points out, this is the one that it doesn't get you paid. I acknowledge that. But doesn't it feel good to have this guy who is stiffing you, who parks wherever he wants, who, even though he's not paying, is not immune from expressing his opinion at your board meetings? You've got that person, right? Who violates all your rules, who makes noise, who does whatever the heck he wants, it is worth it to throw his ass out. It doesn't get you paid, but God, it makes you feel good. And you know what? The owners, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't with your unit owners. Why did you spend the money to throw them out? Because last month, you couldn't stop complaining about getting this guy out of here.
Yeah, okay, like you said, it's on a case-by-case basis on these mortgage foreclosures. I'm going to trial on a mortgage foreclosure next week, and the judge actually said at the pretrial conference last week, well, isn't the bank foreclosing too? Yeah, they're taking forever, Judge. This unit owner has racked up $40,000 in past due. Yeah, and they're playing the system. If the bank's not going to do anything, Judge, we want a trial. Let's try this case, give us the judgment. We'll rip the unit out. You know, maybe we'll contact, maybe once the association takes title, they'll try to do a short sale. Try to hire a distressed real estate property individual to see if they can short sale it.
The point being, and as David correctly pointed out a few minutes ago, this is the conversation you should be having with your lawyer on foreclosures. And I want to take the point that Scott made at the beginning about doing nothing. I will tell you right now what my advice is to every one of my clients. When an owner is delinquent, send them the demand that you always send. If they're monthly, by the end of that first month, the account should be in the hands of your lawyer. If it's quarterly, I still think within 30 or 60 days, the account should be in the hands of your lawyer. Because what happens is, the lawyer, if you're a condo, has to send a 30-day pre-lien notice, record a claim of lien, and then send a 30-day pre-foreclosure notice. That should happen in every case. Because that is a statutory prerequisite to doing what? Filing a foreclosure. and you want to be, you don't necessarily want to file the foreclosure, but you want to be at the precipice of foreclosure so that if you need to fire that gun that you have in your hand, you're ready, it's loaded. You've sat, I mean, you don't, I don't want to say, if you don't pay, I'm going to foreclose you, and you smile at me and says, come back and see me in 75 days when you've done all the statutory stuff that has to be done before foreclosure. You want to be right there at the precipice of foreclosure so that when you've got that obnoxious owner and you want to throw him out, you can file tomorrow. You want to be at the precipice of foreclosure so that if that unit is rented, you satisfied all these statutory prerequisites, so tomorrow you can file your foreclosure and file an emergency motion to get a receiver appointed so you can grab that rent.
You know, one thing too, Ken, I wanted to mention, in a bank foreclosure lawsuit, you as an association will be named as a defendant because you have an interest in the property. One highly effective tool is to have your association attorney be a thorn in the side of the bank's attorney. Okay? And how do you do that? Well, first, quick facts about most of these bank foreclosures. Almost in every case, the attorneys are located in Fort Lauderdale or Tampa. Okay? If you have your attorney represent the association, the defendant association, your attorney can send a letter out to the bank's attorney and say, you haven't done anything in 6 months. Respond to me in 14 days with what you're doing, what your plan is, or I'm going to file a request for a hearing before the judge, and you can explain to the judge why it is you've taken 6 months, 12 months, a year. This is something we're doing routinely in my area over in Sarasota. The judges have become educated on what we're doing, and it's working tremendously. Because what's the number one thing the bank's attorney doesn't want to have to do? Get in their car from Fort Lauderdale and drive to Vieira. Okay? You all know how long that drive is, there and back, and guess who's going to have to pay their fees? The bank. So when you, it's their kryptonite. I call it the kryptonite. Okay? When you basically tell them, you're going to have to get in the car, drive to Vieira, and explain to the judge why it is you've taken 2 years, guess what? When you send that letter out and they know you mean business, typically you get that motion for summary judgment filed the next week, and a lot of times the hearing is the next month, and you get things moving. Because you have to understand, these bank's attorneys, I've talked to some of them, they have 1,000 cases on their docket. You can just imagine how are they going to process 1,000 cases. And by sending these letters and taking this action, what you're really trying to do is you're trying to pull your case out of 972 and try to get it in the top 50. Okay? And sometimes you can get that taken care of with just a simple letter.
Right. And you know, at the risk of Ken beating me up a little bit later about when I say if the bank's foreclosing, do nothing, that's when David says go over the list with your lawyer and look at the ones. If you have a good bank lawyer that has filed the complaint and has a motion for summary judgment pending and turns this case in 6 months, then yes, don't spend any money on that because the bank's going to get to sell that property at foreclosure sale. But the ones where you're racking up $40,000 or you have a tenant and they're paying, you have to look at them on a case-by-case basis. Or like David said, yeah, be aggressive. Go to the hearing, even if you say, judge, I want a receiver in there, or I want the rents deposited in the court registry, you'll wake that bank lawyer up, and he'll come and say, I think, judge, we have a right to get that rent, too. Well, let him do something, judge. We got to keep this thing moving.
And I wasn't beating up on you. I was just trying to keep the conversation lively. I was asked a question, Scott, hang on to the mic, because this is a good one for you. The question from the corner of the room was, what about the banks that foreclose and then don't pay?
Oh, let me at them.
Katie barred the door, right?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, the fact is once the bank forecloses, if they don't sell at a foreclosure sale, then they get the property. And you've got to put them on notice. Hey, congratulations, you're the new neighbor now.
Here's your bill.
It's, you know, in a condo, it's past 6 months or 1% of the mortgage. I forget the magic language, but they'll have to start paying immediately. We have that. We have reputable banks that don't understand. We're getting a check. Once you foreclose on that property, our association's getting a check for the past 6 months.
And for...
any assessments from that day forward. I mean, we're foreclosing on banks now that actually took title. Guess what? You're getting leaned. You're getting foreclosed on, and that's kind of fun, actually.
Because if you do nothing, the bank wants to pay you when?
Right, the bank will get around to paying you.
They want to pay you when?
Never. The bank's lawyers are like,
they want to pay you when they sell.
Right.
It might as well be never in this market.
Right.
No, it's not still the 1%. If the bank forecloses for the past due assessments that came due up to the point that they took title, if a bank forecloses and takes title February 1, 2010, and you have a year and a half of delinquent assessments, the bank's liability, the statutory cap that David referred to at the beginning of our session this morning, the bank's liability for assessments coming due before February of 2010 is capped at the lesser of 6 months or 1% of the original mortgage. But everything that comes due from the date they take title, they owe. And they owe it the same way as every other unit owner owes it. And all of the disincentive for you to foreclose is now gone. Because the whole disincentive for you to foreclose was if the unit was worth 100 and a quarter and the bank was owed 200,000. There was no equity. Guess what? The bank is foreclosed. What happened to the first mortgage, Scott?
It's wiped out.
It's gone. There is no more first mortgage. You have a unit that's owned free and clear. Scott, what do we do with delinquent owners who own their units free and clear?
Oh, yeah, we go after them.
Why?
Nice. No mortgage on that. There's got to be equity.
Why? Of course. So the answer to the question from the corner is that when you have a bank foreclose, if they don't pay you starting immediately, you go after them because now if you foreclose on the property, you have a $125,000 property with how much in liens against it?
Zero.
What's the definition of taking title?
The definition of taking title in a foreclosure context is that you file the lawsuit, you have the court enter a foreclosure judgment, you have the clerk sell the property on the courthouse steps, and after the sale, the clerk issues a certificate of title to the successful bidder. And the way the foreclosure sale process works is that the foreclosing plaintiff, the lender, in bank foreclosure, or you, if you're foreclosing your lien, the lien holder, you have a credit bid for the amount of your judgment.
Which is an extended time frame.
Beg your pardon?
Isn't that an extended time?
The statute requires the foreclosure sale to occur within, I believe,
30
days of the judgment. That's by statute. The sale has to occur within that time frame, and the certificate of title is supposed to be issued within 10 days of the sale.
What if it's not recorded for a year?
Yeah.
The certificate of title is supposed to be issued and recorded within 10 days of the sale. You don't have to take it and go record it like a deed. The clerk records the certificate of title. That's part of their job. That's part of their role.
And also, don't be confused with...
By the way, excuse me one second.
Yes,
are the courts backed up on this?
Just a little bit.
What about property tax companies?
You know what? If all that's against a $125,000 unit is $8,000 in property taxes, that is still a good deal? It's the mortgage that you want to get rid of. The property taxes, the government takes care of themselves. They come first. But the property taxes are never, I have never seen a circumstance where the accumulated property taxes are more than the unit is worth. Not even close.
So the association title prior to the foreclosure by the bank.
What do you think?
Well, I mean, you have title. You're allowed to rent the unit out, and the property taxes are still superior to you're not going to be able to foreclose out the property taxes. You're still going to be the unit. You're going to be responsible for those taxes.
I think the question that I'm asking is do we have to pay them? And the answer to that question is
no. But the property taxes, they can sell it at a tax sale and come take title from you.
They can do the same thing the bank can do. You know what? If the unit is worth nothing to you because of the size of the first mortgage, why would you advance the money to pay the property taxes? You'll rent it out for as long as you can. How are property taxes? I've been going for 2.5 hours. Give me just a second here. How are the property taxes enforced?
They're sold at a tax sale and automatic, and not, and eventually foreclosed on.
Property taxes are due in November. They're considered late in April. 2009 taxes were payable last November. That's when you got your notices. They'll be considered late this coming April 2010. And if they're not paid by June of 2010, the clerk will sell what's called a tax certificate. That's not a foreclosure sale. It doesn't transfer title to the property. It is a sale of a tax certificate. And that tax certificate is a first lien against the property, even prior to the first mortgage. After holding the tax certificate for 2 years, the certificate holder can apply for a tax deed. So why would you be in a rush to pay the property taxes, particularly if they're relatively recent? If the unit has nothing but property taxes against it, and the bank has foreclosed, and it's otherwise free and clear, you better believe you're going to pay the property taxes, because we'll pay $8,000 to sell a $125,000 asset. Of course you wouldn't. But if it's a $125,000 asset, a $200,000 first mortgage, and $8,000 in property taxes, you rent it out for as long as you can. You don't advance. The only money that you should be advancing is the money that has to be advanced to keep the unit from becoming a problem for the neighboring units.
And one thing I get is, I've had this happen on occasion, a president will call me up and say, we're changing the locks because we're foreclosing. No, you don't have any right to touch that unit until you get that certificate of title.
Unless you have a receiver appointed where the court gives you the right to take possession.
Just a real quick question, too. Somebody handed us a note that says, what about if you're foreclosing? What about your attorney's fees? Yes, your documents in the statute give you a right to recover your attorney's fees in the judgment as well.
What happens if somebody just starts stripping the unit? Well, it's in foreclosure.
It's not your unit yet. It's still their unit. The question is, what happens if somebody comes in and starts stripping the unit? Do we have anything? Is there anything we can do about it?
You can go to the court.
Well, by the time you got your order from the court, the refrigerator, the stove, everything's gone.
And that's not uncommon. You know, the homeowner that's really ticked off is pouring cement on the pipe.
See, these gentlemen are saying call the police. Are the police going to intercede?
Probably not. They don't.
Why?
This is a civil matter. We're not going to get involved.
What are they stealing? They're stealing their own stuff. It's their unit. I mean, the police will not get involved because they will say, what's the line?
It's a civil matter.
Well, it's not very civil, but it is a civil matter. That's what the police will say. Beg your pardon? If you have somebody damaging your property, then you have to enforce your documents, and if you have to run to court to get an injunction to stop someone from I mean, that would be your remedy regardless of whether the unit's in foreclosure. If you have a unit owner who's violating your documents in a way that is destroying the property, you're going to do something about it whether they're a deadbeat or not. That's an easy one. Guys, let's use this moment to segue into the discussion about collection and foreclosure generally. You guys should hopefully now have a better idea of how you analyze the decision to foreclose in this terrible market. At least I hope you do, because the discussion that David was talking about having with Scott or Keith Roll or whoever your attorney happens to be is exactly what we've just gone through, which is how do you identify whether a unit is worth the investment to foreclose? And it is not an easy analysis, and I can promise you this, there is no guaranteed correct answer. You are stuck with a choice between the lesser of two unappetizing options. That's the reality. How did we get here? And what can we do to stop it? David, from an association attorney's perspective, if one of these people comes to you and says, Mr. Mueller, what can we do on our documents to better protect ourselves? What do we say? What options can we offer?
You've got several options. You know, certainly you want to amend your documents to give the association more power to approve rentals, approve sales.
What can we do about sales?
Well, one thing you can do about sales is you can put in restrictions where the association has the right to approve sales. It gets a bit tricky, though, because if you want to reject a sale, a lot of times your remedy ends up being buying the unit, which, you know, you may not have the capital. You probably won't have the capital to do.
What about the association that calls and says, we have a buyer here, and his credit history is terrible. Can't we turn him down?
It's a buyer, not a renter.
A buyer.
It's a buyer. again, we were discussing...
By the way, if it's a renter, do we care?
Well, if it's a renter, we may not care. It depends. I mean, if we probably don't care if it's a renter, but again, none of this is paid by numbers.
And the reason I posed the question, it was sort of a loaded question, is because the renter has no direct financial obligation to the association.
Right.
His financial obligation is to
the landlord.
And whether or not that renter pays the landlord has a contractual obligation to us. So for us to reject a tenant because he's got a bad credit report, I think is dubious. Now, you know, if it's Charles Manson, who's the tenant, he's got more dubious things in his background than a bad credit report. But let's shift back to sales, David. If we get a call and the client says, we've got an applicant to buy a unit here, his credit report shows that he's had 3 foreclosures, horrible credit, he doesn't have a job, I mean, the perfect buyer, right? The perfect buyer for 2005. First-time homeowner. And he's pre-approved, by Bank of America, for 95% loan-to-value financing. When I asked how we got to this predicament, that scenario is how we got here. Because it happened all the time. Because they couldn't wait to close the sale, book the loan. The mortgage banker sold the loan to the investment banker. The mortgage broker and the real estate broker both took their commissions. And the investment banker bundled the mortgage and sold the rest of them as securities that were touted as the best thing since tech stocks in the 90s. And everybody was making money until boom. So what do we tell the client who says this person has just horrible credit report? Why should we let them live here? There are foreclosures waiting to happen.
I just want to say for the record, as these questions get tougher and tougher, my voice is going more and more out. So, Scott, you may end up having to answer these. But, no, that scenario you presented is a situation where the association does have the right to reject the potential purchaser. It may want to act upon those rights. The critical distinction here, the critical point, though, is you need to discuss this with your attorney because in many documents, you only have that right if you step up and purchase it yourself. You know, so when you're in those situations, Ken...
I get to ask the questions here. I got the gray hair in this.
I understand it. Man, this voice is really starting to go.
Yeah. No, but seriously, what does the financial statement or the financial history tell you about whether or not they're going to pay? Really, what does it tell you?
It tells you they're not going to pay.
All right, so let's assume that we screened a buyer in 2004 who had all of his assets with the Bernie Madoff Group. And that financial statement looked great. How reliable is a personal financial statement as an indicator of whether someone's going to be able to pay their obligations? Seriously, how reliable is it? Who in this room has the same financial statement now that they had 4 years ago? And how many of you would say it's different, but it's better? Seriously, back to you, how valuable is a personal financial statement as an indicator of whether someone's going to pay? Or how does it protect the association? The whole goal here is to protect the association,
right? Very valuable.
I mean, so they'll say, well, he doesn't have a job, he doesn't have any income. We have 5 million new unemployed people in this country, and those are the ones that we can count. How reliable is that as an indicator of your ability to collect? How do you protect yourselves when you hold a subordinate lien? What do you want to mandate at the time of sale?
You want to mandate that you have someone who has the potential to actually pay your assessments. Other things that you can do to protect yourself, put in the documents, provision, down payment of assessments, prepaying of assessments, so at least you're protected for a certain period of time, whether it's 6 months or 12 months. There's all sorts of things that your association attorney can propose via amendments.
Let's explore that one.
Right.
Because that was the answer I was looking for.
Am I getting an A or B so far in this test?
It's a long exam,
yeah.
And the day is young. David said you can put a down payment requirement in your documents. Now, what kind of buyers will it chase off? The ones you want or the ones you don't want? Is it a desirable thing for you to have buyers who put nothing down? I mean, I would agree with you, ma'am, that it's a desirable thing for you to have buyers. But a buyer who has nothing down will do what when the market turns? Somebody said sell. He's not going to sell. He's not going to sell. What's he going to do? Why is he going to walk away? How much skin does he have in the game? How much loss, how much does he stand to lose from losing the unit? So what's wrong with requiring a buyer to put some money down? What's wrong with that? Ma'am.
I have so much equity in the new car, I won't tell you that what's wrong with it, it's
possibly a sale. A sale to a deadbeat. Thank you very much. You are 100% correct, ma'am, that requiring a down payment will curtail the resale market. David, do pet restrictions curtail the resale market? Do 55 and older restrictions curtail the resale market?
They do.
Do prohibitions against commercial vehicles curtail the resale market? These are all choices you make when you design the documents to govern your community. And you know what? Every one of these choices curtails the resale market because you are saying that people who are going to live here are going to live by this set of rules. And if you don't want to, you're not going to live here. So I go back to my question. What is wrong, first of all, from a practical standpoint, and then I want your technical discussion as to whether or not we can get away with it. But what is wrong with requiring a down payment?
Nothing's wrong with it, and the reality is, in this market, unlike 2005, where you could get an interest-only loan and not have to put anything down, in this market, you're going to, in most cases, have to put down close to 20% to make the purchase anyway.
Thank you, Fannie Mae, right?
Right. Yeah, there's always restrictions now. Banks are now playing by the old rules instead of the new rules.
And if they played by the old rules 4 years ago?
Then we all would have 30 more percent.
We'd still be talking about insurance instead of collections.
Right.
Fannie Mae has imposed new guidelines, have they not?
They have.
How many of you have had people come to you and say, Fannie Mae won't back a mortgage here because we don't have enough reserves? Or because of the number of delinquencies? Fannie Mae requires how much now as a loan-to-value ratio, a maximum loan-to-value ratio for owner-occupied residences? I believe it's 75% loan-to-value is the most that they will loan. It's the most that they will lend on a property if it's going to be a primary residence. How many of the people who bought in the last 10 years had to put down 25%? Let me ask you the question from a different perspective. David and Scott, if you've got a board that is evaluating the financial wherewithal, David, I warned him out, he needs a break. If you're evaluating a potential buyer, and the board has to evaluate the financial wherewithal of the buyer, would you rather the board be making a subjective judgment based upon a financial statement or an income statement, or simply looking at the closing statement and saying, this is the purchase price, this is how much has to be put down?
I think, obviously, the former, the subjective, but the rub is, and I think...
You'd rather the board be looking at the subjective analysis?
I'd rather them look at, if they have two buyers to pick from, take the buyer that's more viable. I think Ken's point is valid, that you want to get more discerning, and if you can rely on a reasonable basis for denying that sale and put that in the minutes, then do so. That assumes you have more than one buyer. And because a lot of these associations will take the first buyer that comes along, just what Ken's point is be careful about that. You know, maybe get a little more discernible so you don't have this collections problem later.
If we go in front of a judge with an owner who lost a sale because we looked at the personal financial statements, and the owner comes into the hearing saying, you cost me a sale, and here's the underwriter from Bank of America that approved them for a loan, who are you to say they're not creditworthy? How do you like your chances in that hearing?
At the same time, I have to tell the judge, it's something called a business judgment rule. You can't replace your business judgment for this board of directors' business judgment. And it's going to be a tough uphill battle. I understand that. But you've got to establish some parameters for getting your collections under control. If you've got a couple of different buyers, it's not a bad idea to look at their financial background.
You have a board that changes every year. Sometimes it changes multiple times within a year. And based on some of the questions I've heard today, some of you have no board at all. Are you sure that the measure of financial wherewithal for buyers this year is going to be the same that it will be next year with a different board.
Well, and that's what the judge is going to say. How are you going to be able to tell just by looking at a financial statement?
I mean, you're not only board members, you're also unit owners, right? Aren't you entitled to some protection here, too, so that when you sell your units, you know there's going to be some definable standard by which your buyers, your potential buyers, are going to be measured? I mean, you're correct about the business judgment rule, and would you, just for the sake of everybody's knowledge here, define what the business judgment rule is?
Well, basically, that a board is protected. I don't know the exact legalese. I'd have to go back and look at the book, but is that the courts are not allowed to use boards, corporations, board of directors' decisions as fodder and rethink them. If the court is not in the best position to know what's right for that corporation.
And is not going to substitute its judgment.
There's the magic language. It's not going to substitute its judgment for the board's judgment unless it just flies in the face of good judgment.
Okay.
Can we turn the disco ball on?
Doesn't tell you what their future's going to be, though. Think about it for a second, folks. Let me take the devil's advocate argument to what you're saying. As a board, aren't you going to have continuity if the financial decision is based upon creating an equity cushion to protect the association? Doesn't that guarantee you that 20% of the purchase price is 20% now, is 20% next year, is 20% 5 years from now, regardless of how much the unit sells for? 20% is 20%. There's no discretion there, correct?
It's in the documents,
there's no discretion. Furthermore, you may have a buyer that has an excellent credit report, an excellent financial statement, a decent income, and when that unit goes into foreclosure, they have no equity. Now, obviously, we've had an unprecedented drop in real estate values, but if someone is required to put down 20%, I see right off the top of my head three distinct advantages. Number one, the standard that is applied to financial wherewithal of buyers, and I'm using 20% just as an arbitrary figure. You can use whatever you want. But the standard that is applied to the financial wherewithal of buyers doesn't change from year to year when the board changes. It is not subjective, and therefore it's less likely to be considered to be an unreasonable restraint on alienation. Number two, you have created an equity cushion. What that means is that there's some equity there in the property, so when the foreclosure hits, there's actually some value to you. And number four, remember our discussion a little while ago about buyers not having any skin in the game and what's likely to happen when the chips fall? Now I put down 20%. On a $200,000 unit, I put down $40,000. Am I more likely or less likely to bail out when things get bad? Now, is it legal?
Sure. I mean, if you've got a board resolution or if it's in your documents or your rules and regulations or if you have a policy, let's say you've adopted a policy for what the board's discretion would be for reviewing what potential buyers, the standards, some general standards for potential buyers. Anything you can hang your hat on in court.
I know you're going to agree to me because you hold me in the highest esteem, but isn't the analysis that I just made the argument to make to the judge as to why this is a legal restriction? Because it doesn't create an unreasonable restraint, because it is definable, because we have a subordinate lien position, which we have a right to protect, which means we want there to be some equity over and above the first mortgage, and we're entitled to have owners put some money down and have some skin in the game. Now, I will tell all of you this, you can't enforce this kind of standard unless you do what? Amend what document? Can you do this through rules?
No.
Why not?
Because the declaration trumps the bylaws trump the articles trump the rules. So you want to go to the higher authority. Declaration controls.
Well, you're discriminating against people who can't afford to live there. You know what? They're not a protected class, are they?
Not yet. Give it a couple of years.
Every restriction you put in your documents discriminates against somebody. The question is whether or not it's illegal discrimination. Yes, sir. The gentleman says for being appointed a receiver, how many thousands of dollars is it going to cost?
It's going to cost you a couple of grand, probably minimum.
A month?
Yeah. It varies. That's why...
in the statute, it references appointment of a receiver to collect rents, but...
Yeah.
Okay, you're talking about actually having a receiver when there's no board members, or a receiver to collect rents? Collect rents? Okay. If you get to that point, you should have the discussion with your lawyer to do what Scott suggested, which is to go to the court and say, Your Honor, we don't, it's 2010, we don't have a lot of money, we're not really that excited about, you know, helping out the receiver to make their Porsche payments, okay? So can you order the tenants to pay the money directly in the court registry? And then the judge can enter an order saying how that money is going to be doled out. That's an effective alternative that many judges will go for. You can avoid the receiver altogether.
And Scott, have you seen many receivership orders and seen how the judges delineate their payment?
No, the judges, they don't even understand what the parameters are for a receiver. I mean, they're not even reading.
Careful now, though. Maybe
not. With all due respect to the judge I'm going in front of next week, I hope they're not here, but it's a very tough standard, and it's tough for a judge to come because they know receiver is a big word, and they just, you know, they don't really understand what the parameters are for. They'll be like less than likely to award a receiver. So a cheaper option may be you just put the rents in the court registry, and every 35, 60 days, I just make a motion to take those rents out and give them to you.
Receivers are typically paid either a percentage or by the hour.
The other thing I want to mention is this language is in the Fasano Bill, 1196, which will allow associations to collect delinquent assessments directly from the tenant without having to go through a lawsuit.
Without having to file a foreclosure.
Without having to go
through a lawsuit. Very important addition to the statute. This is one of those amendments that actually will get you paid. The suspensions of use rights, they may make you feel better, but they probably are not going to get you paid. And this is a very important one because a lot of you have been sitting there saying, well, the director says, should we do nothing or should we file a foreclosure? Well, of course he wants us to file a foreclosure because we spend money on lawyers. You know what? If the statute is amended to allow you to grab the rents without having to file a foreclosure, think about how much better your position is now. You don't have to spend the money to file the foreclosure. All you do is you send a demand to the tenant and say, give us the darn rents. It's a substantial improvement in your rights. But the real issue, folks, and then I want to just open it up for questions. The real issue with collection and foreclosure is not collecting the rents. It's not appointing receivers. It's not suspending unit owners' use rights or suspending their voting rights. What is the real issue with the foreclosure crisis? It's being able to get the money that's due and having a cash flow you can meet your expenses. And there's only one place that's going to come from. There's only one solution to the problem that is actually permanent and significant. And what is it?
Make those that got the $700 billion pay a little bit to us, the actual people.
So we're not getting bailed out from both directions, right?
Yeah.
What are you doing when you are paying for that insurance premium, paying for the audit, paying for the engineering report, funding the reserves, maintaining the property, maybe even going into the unit and paying FPL? What are you doing, realistically speaking, practically speaking, what are you doing for the bank?
You're protecting the bank's collateral.
You are protecting and preserving the value of the bank's collateral. For whose benefit? Is there some reason why the bank, as David, which is a twist of bitterness, points out, the bank that has $800 billion of our tax dollars, is there some reason why you should be footing the bill to protect and preserve their collateral while they have a limited liability, a statutory cap of 6 months or 1%? Why? And what do the banks say to our legislators when we tell them we'd like to amend this law? What do they threaten to do?
They threaten to basically stop lending money in Florida. They threaten to say, well, if you do that, we're just going to pull out completely and you know, have fun in Florida without any lending to purchase any of these properties.
And does anybody believe that?
No.
I mean, how easy is it to get a loan now anyway? It's pretty tough. They've already done it, exactly. But that's the, rather than make an equitable argument or even a legal argument as to why the statute shouldn't be changed, what they do is they do the same thing that a 5-year-old would do. Well, I'm going to pick up my marbles and go home. To which I would like to say, don't let the door hit you on the ass on the way out. Unfortunately, when legislators hear that kind of threat, they get panicky.
I think it's also important to point out, especially in light of our wonderful sponsor here today, we're really talking about...
Others.
Yeah.
Present company
except... It's pretty clear who we're talking about when we talk about the banks. We're talking about, the big banks up in Wall Street. The local banks, if you have the pleasure of dealing with them, a lot of these problems can just be completely avoided. So I just want to make that clear. We're talking about the big boys. Okay?
You have to make your voice is heard on this issue. The mortgage bankers lobby is the most formidable, best funded lobby there is. And last year when this issue was discussed, do you know what the bankers lobby was saying? This is Travis. I should have had Travis say this while he was here. Do you know what the mortgage bankers lobby was saying to your legislators? They were saying, this is in the dictionary next to the word chutzpah. They were saying to your legislators that it's your fault because you should have turned down the buyers if they were unqualified. Now, what would have happened if you had turned down one of those buyers? You bet you would. All hell would have broken loose, and you would have been on the defensive. But that, I kid you not, Travis reported that back to me. That's what the bankers' lobby was telling your legislators was the cause of the problem, was that you should have just turned down these unqualified buyers. There's a word for that. I don't know you all well enough to speak it yet. You have to make your voices heard on this. You have to write to your legislator and say, I don't want to be able to make the owner sit in the guest lane, which, by the way, I don't think you can do anyway. I don't want to be able to turn off his cable if he doesn't live here anyway, or suspend his voting rights if he's never been to a meeting. I want the banks to pay because we are, as David very correctly points out, paying as a community to subsidize them by preserving their collateral. And the best way to explain the point to your legislator or to your banker is to say, if I own a single family home that is not part of an association, and I let the home deteriorate, and the bank forecloses and takes title, who has to pay to put the unit back in a saleable condition? Not so in a condo. Bank's got all of you to make sure that unit is maintained, so that when they get around to taking title, thank you very much for keeping it neat and clean and sanitary. I'll just take this off your hands and sell it now. And here's your 6 months or 1%. Who decided that was a good deal? But who made that law? Not the banks. Your legislators did. We have a legal system in this particular area, and if you can tell, I feel strongly about it. We have a legal system in this area that is designed to funnel bad debt to the people who least deserve to have to pay for it. The people who put down roofs in your community did not buy investment property at the peak of the market, did not lend on investment property at the peak of the market, were never in it to make a buck. They were in it to buy a home, and they've been paying their mortgage for 10, 15, 20, 30 years. They paid it off. They've sunk down roofs, and now they're having to absorb the loss for the people who were in it to make a buck. And that galls me, and it should gall you. And you should make sure your legislators know about it. And you can use the call website, you can use your own resources, but make sure they know that you're watching. This issue has been discussed for 3 years now. The first couple of years when I brought this up, I got laughed out of the room. I feel like Don Quixote on this issue. But somebody in the legislature has to have the intestinal fortitude, the political courage, to stand up and say, okay, the rest of the country doesn't do this, but Florida is foreclosure central in the United States. I'm sure everybody felt good when Todd announced the fact that you're now the top five. So let's just go to questions. I have a couple written here, then I'll take hands. How much info do we need to put in our directory for our community? That's an interesting question. David?
How much info? Well, you've got in your directory, It's different than the official records. I think we need to make that distinction first of all. There's really no legal requirements for a directory that I'm aware of, so you basically have discretion to do what you want to do. What's a good idea? A good idea is to have a list of the owners and then be very sensitive towards this personal information we talked about, such as emails, cell phone numbers, things like that.
Can the board of directors place different use restrictions on people who are not paying?
Well, in this Fasano bill, 1196, if you are delinquent in the payment of the assessments, you will then have the ability, again, if this law goes through, to suspend voting rights and even common element use rights. So the answer to that question is, after this bill goes through, if it does go through, that will be very easy to do. Right now, not so much.
Like those people that are paying still get to go sit next to you at the pool.
Right
now.
I'm getting this question a lot. This is the last one I'm going to read, and then I'll take your hands because I want to give everybody a chance. I'm getting this one a lot because boards are turning over right now. Our treasurer has kept all of our financial records on his own computer. He's not our treasurer anymore. How do we get our records back?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. I have an association who is getting ready to embark on a big-time lawsuit because their manager, it's a multi-condo association, and their manager of 10 years stole $8 million from them over a 10-year period. The issue is we need to get the records to our forensic accountant to find out exactly how much money was stolen, and guess who has the records?
Who do the records belong to?
Records belong to the association. So, and this, it's funny this question came up because we had to file a lawsuit to get an order from the court to obtain the financial records from the former treasurer, who effectively dodged service from our process server for about 2.5 months.
Why in the world does the guy want to keep hostage the financial records of the association? I mean, I can only think of one reason. All right, let's use our last 10, 15 minutes just to take questions from the floor. Yes, ma'am. I'll repeat the questions.
I have a retro question.
Try to keep them short so we can get as many as possible.
When you're going to be on the board and you have to sign the statement that you...
The certification.
Certification. So you sign it, understand it to the best of your ability. Okay.
Yep, that's what it says. It's the best of your ability, which raises the question of what is it worth in the first place?
Right.
Other than that it scares off conscientious people.
Yeah.
Who else has a question? Yes, sir.
This is going to be a very simple question.
I hope so.
How do I find out that the bank is foreclosing on one of my companies?
How do you find out that the bank is foreclosing, Scott? Well, what else has to happen?
Well, the bank would have to name the association. You would be you'd name defendant because you have an interest in the property, so you would be served with the lawsuit. That's how you would find out.
You're going to be sued. Well, the defendant junior lien holder.
And Ken, I want to bring one point up, and this is a very important point. 5% of the time, you won't be named as a defendant due to sloppy lawyering by the bank's attorney.
And you want to do what?
And you want to keep quiet and do nothing.
Because?
Because when they finally take title, you're going to hit that bank with a request for everything. And when they say, well, wait a minute, you know, the statutory cap, yada, yada, statutory cap, yada, yada, you're going to say, well, guess what? Your junior's attorney forgot to name us as a...
We're not going to go quite that
far. Well, that's what I would do.
You're going to deal with that genius again in the future.
No, you are. But the key there is, once you make that, and usually you have that conversation with the bank's attorney who forgot, you may manage to get a check paid pretty quickly. So that's the one little caveat here, the little secret. If you don't get named as a defendant,
the bank's right to enjoy the statutory cap is conditioned upon the bank naming you as a defendant junior lead holder, your genius attorney. How is this kid right?
Now, here's the counter to that dirty little secret. There is the potential that the bank can say, okay, you want to play hardball with me? I'm going to re-foreclose you out and start the process over again. That's a little caveat. It gets complicated.
But it's a valid point because there's some strategy here. Other questions? Sir.
You're talking about not getting enough people to run to the floor. There are certain things you can do about it, but you suggested that you could get a group of owners together and could they make nominations from the floor and elect the new board right from the floor without a quorum?
In a condo, you have to follow the statute, and you have to, the notice of intent and whatnot. The scenario I was talking about is, let's say no one submits the notice of intent, and you only have two board members remaining when you actually have a five-person board. The key there is to have a meeting, really publicize it, explain to the entire community that if we don't get some volunteers, we're in serious financial jeopardy, and then get some names, and then the board can nominate or can appoint those folks who have interest, who they think would be good board members, and then those folks come on the board, and then next time around when you have your annual meeting, you'll figure out who's up. So it's not a... Going forward, as you approach the annual meeting, you have to follow the requirements, but after the fact, the board can appoint to fill vacant spots.
Also, one of the benefits of having staggered terms, so that you never run the risk of having a year where the entire board comes up for election and nobody puts their name in. The benefit of staggered terms is there's always a group of board members that have another year to go, so you don't have to replace the entire group. Yes, ma'am.
Regarding insurance. What is the individual owner now required?
Well, that's a good question. What is the individual owner now required to carry in terms of insurance? And the true answer to that question is...
The statute is interpreted now to mean, in my opinion, that unit owners do have to have insurance.
And I agree. It's not clear, though, is it?
It's not clear, but that's a requirement. So you might say to yourself, well, what does that mean? What's the enforcement mechanism? The only obligation upon the association and the board is in a condo, once a year, you have to send out a letter to all your unit owners, and you have to request information regarding whether or not they have HO6 unit owner insurance. You've got to send that letter out every year. That is the last mandatory requirement of the law. Everything else is optional. If no one responds to you at all, you don't have to do anything. If everybody responds, you don't have to do anything else. You have the option, if you find out that a unit owner does not have HO6, you have the option to go forward and force place insurance, put insurance on that unit against the unit owner's will. You have the right to lien for those expenses. Nobody's doing that. Very few people are doing that. Why? Because you then have to put the money out up front to get the insurance policy. Yes, you can lien for it, but as we've heard from the past, hour long discussion, just because you can lien for something doesn't mean you're going to get paid in 2010.
Is it a good thing for the owners to have property damage insurance? Of course it is. Because if you have a hot water leak on the third floor and the owner on the second floor doesn't have insurance, what is the owner on the second floor going to do? He's going to blame somebody. Because it's America. And if I spill my coffee that I bought at McDonald's and it's too hot, it's their fault. It's always better to have people carry insurance because it provides financial accountability to the rest of the community. But is it the province of the state to say to everybody who buys a unit in a condominium that you're required to go buy insurance? I'm not so sure that it is. Particularly when it creates a burden on the association, because you as board members are obliged to enforce the statute and enforce your documents, and the only way to enforce this particular obligation is, as David just said, is to go into your own pocket to force place a policy against someone that hasn't paid assessments for 2 years. Why on earth would you do that? Particularly when the association's policy will be enough in the event of a casualty to restore the building to the bare walls, floors, and ceilings anyway. I would like to see the statute amended to provide for protections for what the minimum requirements are for unit owner policies like loss assessment, but I would like to see it left to the community to amend their own documents to determine whether or not to mandate coverage. Ma'am?
What if you are able to enforce the homeowner's policy in
The question was, what if you're able to get an endorsement on your homeowner's policy from your home in another state? And the first answer is, I'm not an expert on insurance policies, but if you have coverage for your unit here from a viable insurance company, I don't care what state they're in. I don't care if they're in a state of paranoia. As long as you have coverage, you have some financial wherewithal to respond to a crisis. The gentleman in the back.
Question about the requirement to name the association's co-payee.
Take two more questions.
Insurance policy.
It's coming out of the statute this year.
Yeah.
And actually not co-payee, it's actually co-insured, an additional name insured, and it creates a heck of a logistical problem, because it means every time a check is issued on that policy, it's got to be made payable to both. Why? Why do I need to take be a co-payee on the payment of your insurance proceeds on a claim? I don't think it really protects the association. I'll take two more questions and then we're going to say good day. Ladies first.
Our docs call for 5 people and 4 people ran, so we're automatically elected. Do we have to appoint that person, or can we go with the 4 people?
In that situation, if you have 4 or 5 and there's no notice of intent to run, you can continue with a 4-person board. The question is that a good idea? I always get a little nervous with even number board members. Makes me a little nervous. So I would prefer an odd number of board members.
Well, but can you go with 4? What if the bylaws say the board will be 5 persons?
But the counter to that is, what if you've tried real hard to get volunteers and there's no one willing to?
Well, the better answer...
Sorry, I know you asked the question, so...
I treat your questions as answers.
Sorry.
There is no time frame in any law that I'm aware of, nor have I ever seen it in a document, that says you've got to appoint someone to fill a vacancy within X number of days or weeks. But most bylaws, well-written bylaws, say the board shall be a specified number. A lot of you have those old bylaws that say not less than 3 nor more than 7. And by the way, if that's what they say, the law requires your board to be 5 anyway. Because that's what the statute says if the bylaws aren't clear. So if you are required to have a board of 5, there's no deadline for you to fill that vacancy. But as a matter of law, as a matter of obligation, the board is, in my opinion, obliged to fill the vacancy. I'll take one more question and then everybody can go to their tea times. In the back, you get the... Yes, did nobody behind you? Can you shut off the cable if someone is not paying and either living there or has a tenant living there? Well, first of all, you have a bulk cable contract. Is the cable company going to reduce the subscription fee by the amount of that unit's share? So cutting off the cable really does nothing more than give them a little turn of the screw, and it is not, under the current law, an authorized remedy. Is it, Scott? And I would submit to you that it's not a remedy that is likely to get you paid, because they can contact the cable company and have it turned back on and just pay them directly. So they generally won't do that, but is it going to get you paid? In that case, knock yourselves out. Anyone
ask? No.
Ladies and gentlemen, we really appreciate your time and attention this morning. We hope you found it informational. We hope you found it valuable. Thank you very much.
Just a quick reminder that we have at the Comfort Inn, February 27th, there will be another meeting. We will be giving out to anybody who comes a copy of 718, the Condominium Act, and a DVD from the division. And our speaker at that particular meeting will be a Miss Danielle Cowell. She used to be the ombudsman for the state. And we hope to see you all there. If you have any questions for call for the Community Association Lobby, their email address is call@www.callbp.com. For the people here, we have mailed you all some ballots and some election material, because Space Coast is having your elections next month. If you have not done the ballots, will you please do the ballot that we sent for the amendments and also the election process? We appreciate it. Thank you very much. Have a great day.